started. Welcome, Chief Justice Kite. And if you, our format, we've basically, if you'd like to introduce your team and give us a brief overview of all your activities the last year, and then we'll just go through your budget pretty much page by page. I think we kind of do this a team effort here. So I think Representative Nicholas, this is your agency on the floor, and I think Senator Perkins. So these get, we want to make sure they have all their questions answered before you leave today. We certainly wouldn't want to do callbacks next week. So we want to get it all out if we can today and make sure for sure these two gentlemen have their questions. Members, any comments before we get started? Okay, so welcome, and the floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We appreciate the time that you spend in this chore, and obviously it's very important to the courts of Wyoming that we have this time with you. So I will introduce, first of all, the folks that are with me here today, and all of the members of the Supreme Court are here, starting with Justice Hill, who's sitting right over here. Most of you know everyone. Justice Burke is with us today, Justice Mike Davis, and our newest Justice Kate Fox is with us today, and I think she had an opportunity to meet many of you, and those that she hasn't will try to do so during the break. Also, we wouldn't be here today if it weren't for the person on my right, which is our court administrator, Joanne Odendahl. Most of you know Joanne, and she's been our budget officer for many years. Sitting next to her is Christy Racinas, who is our new chief financial officer. This budget work, as you know, gets more and more complicated, and Christy has been a tremendous help to us. Stephen Dreher is also here, our court technology officer, who will be addressing you and talking about the technology requests. Rhonda Munger is here, who is our deputy court administrator. She's the one that knows everything about the weighted caseload study and how we measure the workload in the courts. Also with us today is District Judge Nick Deegan from Campbell County. And we thought we might have Judge Norm Young from Fremont County because he has a special request, but I'm not sure he was able to get here. So if not, Judge Deegan will address the district court budget requests. We also have Andy Dorsch, who is right in the back. She is the director of the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid, which, as you all recall, is the organization that was funded with the $10 filing fee 3 or 4 years ago and coordinates and provides legal services to the qualified individuals around the state. And we have some issues and some discussion of that budget, and so she's here to answer any questions that you might have in that regard. A couple things just as an overview. The courts obviously remain busy. Our case filings are relatively stable. They do fluctuate with the economy like everything else does, and they're very hard to predict. So they remain on course. And compensation, as is always the case, is critical for those that work in the judicial branch. And 3 or 4 years ago, when the legislature increased the judges' salaries significantly, that has paid dividends in a big way. You all, I think, are aware that we've had a tremendous turnover in judges. We've appointed 11 new judges since that pay raise was passed. And with this statistic actually stunned me, in the next 2 years, 17 of our judges will turn 65. Now, that doesn't mean they'll retire, because obviously mandatory retirement is at 70. But we are seeing judges willing and interested in retiring before that time. And so we do predict that we're going to see a very significant turnover. And the pay was very critical to our attracting qualified candidates. Our Judicial Nominating Commission has been swamped, and you'll see that in the budget. We have a request for an increase there in their travel. They have really been working hard on these openings. We've got another one that we're addressing here in Laramie County this next week. And so that I don't see that changing. So the legislature's attention to the judicial salaries came at a critical time and was very much appreciated. Compensation for our employees has been kind of a bumpy road, you may recall. We are very pleased that the governor has included, so we all go forward at the same time, judicial employees and his recommendation with regard to compensation increases, and we heartily support that request. We have, I don't know the total number of employees, but we've got employees all over the state of Wyoming, primarily in the circuit courts and the district courts, as you know. And those employees are competing with private industry, and their jobs are getting more demanding from the standpoint of technology, and it's critical that we keep their compensation competitive. So we are hopeful that request will be looked upon favorably by the whole legislature. A second issue that's not directly in our budget is the court security funding bill that was really born out of this committee, and we're hopeful that will be successful. We've worked with the county commissioners and with the lawyers around the state to try to generate support so that all the members of the legislature know how critical that is to us. The current funding of that, you all know, is at $10 million. There's a lot of interest out there, and we see counties looking more carefully at their security situations and evaluating them. We know that Fremont County will be first in line, probably, because their concerns were the ones that actually generated the bill. We know Sweetwater County is also on tap and is really getting well organized and has a great program of getting everybody involved in the discussion as to what's needed in security, and I suspect they will be in line for an application. So the $10 million is going to go quickly, I predict, but it will go to a good cause and it will go where it's needed. The way the bill is structured now, it has the Court Security Commission demonstrating and evaluating priorities, and we don't know exactly what direction that'll take, but the need is certainly there. So again, we very much appreciate the leadership this committee showed in stepping up and suggesting what we think is really a state obligation, at least a state partnership with the counties to house the courts in safe facilities.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Chairman, while we're on that subject, Marilyn, as you've talked to people around the state, have you had any feedback about the language in the bill and the mechanism and how we set it up to facilitate it, and also about the matching component?
You know, I certainly haven't had any criticism of it. Everybody would like more money, always, but the structure of it, I think people are satisfied that the criteria are broad enough that they'll cover most counties should they come forward. And I think my reaction to the discussion is that everybody recognizes there should be a matching component and that the counties should have partial responsibility in coming forward. So I guess I can say I haven't had any negative. I've had a lot of positive.
Okay.
And finally, I want to talk just a little bit about technology, because the majority of our supplemental request is in technology. This, again, the legislature was really the instigator, shall we say, in a lot of our efforts in technology, and gave us the direction and the funding to get the courts on the same computer system and in a system that will allow the courts to manage themselves effectively. And as you know, prior to the installation of our current docket management system, we had five or six different computer systems in the district courts around the state. No ability to communicate, no ability to really have even the judge be able to carefully manage their own dockets. So for the last 3 or 4 years now, we have been designing and implementing a docket management system in the district courts. We started in the Supreme Court, you may recall, back in 2007, and it's a much simpler process. And that has been working well, and people can electronically file, and the public can read documents on our system online, and all of us in the courts can do that as well. The district court, the design of the system was tremendously complicated, because you have 23 different courts and you have 23 different elected district court clerks who all have their own systems and methods of managing information. And so that we chose to not take an off-the-shelf product, but to design a system that fit Wyoming. The district court clerks and Stephen and his shop have been working diligently for the last 4 or 5 years to get that system underway, and I can say today that 22 of the counties are online. Laramie County is is coming online within the next month. And the reaction of everybody is that they are pleased with it. It's like any other computer system. It's an iterative process, and there will be changes over time, and we'll find glitches and we'll work through them. But right now, it's a tremendous success, and it had to be the first piece on top of that docket management system. We will now begin designing an electronic filing system. And the federal courts have been in this using technology in this way for probably 8 or 10 years. I those of you who practice in federal court know that makes it easier for everybody, but it was a lot easier in the federal context to dictate because they're one managed organization than it is in all the multiple districts around the state that we had to face. So we expect within, every time I promise a deadline, we don't seem to make it in the projecting out how we're going to, not just the courts, but I'll talk to you a little bit about electronic citations and highway patrol. It's hard to get these things implemented, but we're confident we'll have electronic filing in place by the end of this coming year. They tell me we might even have it by the summer, but it is now that the docket management system is in place, that's the next piece. And then we will move to the circuit courts. That's going to be a little easier to accomplish simply because they're already on the same system. We've been managing the circuit courts that the Supreme Court has. And so we have to design that system and create it and have it be able to fit with the district court system, but it's not going to be quite as complicated a process as it was with the district courts. So this technological process is, and Stephen will talk about it in a timeline, has been funded sort of in pieces, and most of that request that you'll see in front of you is to keep that system up to date and to accomplish the next steps down the road. Another part of the technology budget is a new project that we had the opportunity last night to visit with your two chairmen about, and that is trying to make better use of space that we have in our building and accomplish the civics education responsibility that we see the courts have in a better way, in a more effective way. We have hundreds of students and adults that come through our building over the years, over a year, and virtually nothing to show them but hallways and a courtroom. And as you know, it's difficult to teach anything to this generation that doesn't have technology involved in it. We had 2 years ago instigated the iCivics program, which is a national program that was spawned by retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and it's actually a computer game aimed at middle school children that teaches them how courts function. Started out with just courts, and then it worked so well they realized it should be all government. And we had a conference of civics, social studies teachers from around the state 2 years ago with a video conference with Justice O'Connor, which was very effective, and introduced iCivics to the middle school teachers and high school teachers around the state. We're going to repeat that effort this coming February, and those teachers also all come and watch you all in the process of the session as well. Watching how iCivics functions and how effective it is. And then we had the opportunity to view a judicial learning center that Colorado designed, which is really a kind of a state-of-the-art operation. And it caused us to realize we could do something much smaller but very effective here in Wyoming. And it's essentially creating interactive displays that allow them to see how courts truly function and lets them operate as a judge and determine what sentence they should impose under a certain factual situation, and introduces them to their judges who are out around the state. And we have some space in our library that we think we can do a much smaller, more modest version of that kind of a learning center. But of course, it has the primary need is technology, because we'll need the software and the screens and that kind of thing. When you come over to our legislative breakfast, we're hopeful to show you a part of that. Colorado has been tremendously generous and essentially giving us the content that they spent a lot of time and money creating. So there's a, and we'll go through this in more detail, but there's a $280,000 supplemental request to be the essentially the seed money to get us started. We have some opportunities for grants that we think are going to be relatively likely, but they require matching money, and nobody's talking about a tremendous expense. But when those students now come through our building, we'll have the opportunity to utilize that space that's on the first floor of our building in a much more effective way. So to the extent you have time and interest and you want to come over, we can show you the area and explain it in greater detail. You have in front of you in your packets a brochure that we created trying to kind of get across the point of what we're trying to accomplish. Has this fold out. And we invite you to ask any questions or come take a look at what we have up our sleeves, and it'll be in, it is included in our the technology portion of our budget. And I think that's everything I needed to say. We'll go through the budget page by page, and when we do that, I'm going to turn this mostly over to Joanne, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Members, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Talk to me about your docket, and we talked a little bit about last night, you know, what the load is and how you're dealing with it, and is there anything that reaches out and grabs you in terms of loads or what's going on in our state, you know, more cases, less cases? Could you speak to that, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The caseloads are relatively stable. We have our weighted caseload study for 2013 shows 16,700 filings in district court. It gets a little complicated when you look at this caseload study because we've taken in the domestic relations area, we've taken out modifications, which essentially in any district judge will tell you that you never have just one divorce. When you have a divorce, you have multiple modifications that come thereafter. And so we tried to count that more accurately, and that compares to approximately 12 or 13,000 the prior year. So it looks like more, but we're counting these more accurately. It's not, it's kind of an apples and oranges situation. It's relatively flat. In the circuit courts, we have a total of 182,000 cases filed. You'll remember that we changed the jurisdiction of the circuit courts, and so their filings, so it's again, it's kind of an apples and oranges. Their filings went up because we took some off of the district courts. And that, frankly, by all accounts, is working very well. The district judges, I don't think, see a dramatic drop, but they do notice that the smaller cases they're not having to deal with. The circuit court clerks saw a rise, and we knew that would happen because a lot of the circuit, the small 50,000 and under cases are go by default, and they require clerk work but not judge work. So it definitely increased the work of the circuit court clerks. And in our docket, our Supreme Court docket sort of rides on what's going on at the district court level, and it's been up and down, but not a dramatic change one way or the other. I think we just are in the process of initiating a rule in circuit court that has been a process that's been followed in other states. They get a huge volume of collection cases, for example, and many times they can't get service on those that they file. Well, that requires the filing of the complaint, and it requires the circuit court, obviously, to enter all the data and then to track the amount of time that they have to serve and then to default them and then to dismiss and to deal with cases that never, in fact, come to fruition. So the court just approved a rule last week that will allow, in those smaller cases, for people to get service first, and then if they have service, file a case. And we think that's going to help with the circuit court clerk workload in keeping cases that we're never going to get going anyway out of the system. So we have worked, and there are hot spots sort of around the state. Frankly, Fremont County is one of them. Sweetwater County is another one. I think Natrona County is another one where the caseloads in the district courts are higher than the judges available to service them. And so it's like anything else in the state, you know, it's not uniform across the state. But the caseload study, which I think that is in our budget. The summary of the clerks is in the, of the circuit court clerks is in how many clerks we think are needed. Casper still is underserved by clerks. So there are places in the state where the staffing is not adequate. We've got judges, and as I say, particularly in those counties I mentioned, district judges that are really stretched. But we've got district judges moving around and helping each other out. So if you look at across statewide, we're fairly well staffed. But there is going to come a time in those in Sweetwater and Fremont and Natrona where there's going to be a need for more judges.
And one other question, too, Mr. Chairman, and I know maybe it was last year where you were charged with trying to come up with some internal ways to be more cost-effective, and I know that you might have been working with the Judiciary Committee on a particular, I think it might have had to do with magistrates, I can't remember for sure. Did that ever get any legs, or is that issue pretty well dead and you didn't even do it during the interim?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the magistrate bill passed, which would allow the court not to fill a magistrate position if it became open, essentially. It's not a perfect fix because it's not clear that you can simply remove the magistrate. We have asked the circuit court's judges, and they have been studying how to manage those. They're called full-time magistrates, but they have a very small workload, and they're paid a reduced salary and benefits, and they're in some of the smaller districts, and that was a result of the compromise that was made when circuit courts were established. So there hasn't been any change. I guess that's the short answer, but that doesn't mean we aren't continuing to look at it and look at the compensation formulas and try to get more efficient, because we do have district circuit judges that are willing to travel. But the structure doesn't encourage that because there's a full-time magistrate in that position. So there'd have to be probably more legislative changes in order to make a dramatic change in that area. But it's a price tag of about $300,000+, and so it's something worth looking at. We have, I don't know if your question is more on the efficiency of the course, or we also have what we call a Rule 1 initiative where we're trying to look at ways our rules and procedures could cause civil cases to get through faster and cheaper. That's a long, sort of laborious process, but I think we have some interesting ideas coming on that front, too, and particularly in the area of domestic relations. I mean, everybody that has had to deal with the courts and the courts themselves, as you struggle with domestic relations, it's terribly time-consuming. It's disruptive and difficult for families. It strikes me personally, frankly, that there just has to be a better way, and we're continuing to try to examine that. But change is difficult in any organization, and certainly difficult in the courts.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Chairman and Chief Justice, I'm sort of along the same lines. I'm wondering what you've seen as far as the change in the circuit court rules and the efforts in that arena to kind of speed things up and keep things more efficient in the circuit courts. Are you seeing some success, or are parties generally pleased with how that's going?
Mr. Chairman, the changes we made when we changed the jurisdiction, the circuit court adopted these new rules, which are very streamlined and, you know, no depositions, no lengthy discovery, limited witnesses, trial in 7 months, I think it is. And there's a lot of pushback, a lot of lawyers struggling with it. But anecdotally, what we're hearing is that the circuit judges are saying they ultimately like it, and the attorneys that have smaller cases are able to say, let's take this to circuit court and get it through quickly, knowing what they're going to be facing, a much simpler process. And having smaller trials and getting to trial in circuit court. So we can't show you that quantitatively, but the anecdotal reaction we're getting is very positive. And it's really a kind of a laboratory for how we can do things in district court, ultimately testing them in the circuit courts and seeing that it works, and then trying maybe eventually to either up that. There's no circuit courts. The circuit courts are listening out there. Don't panic. But increase the jurisdiction a little bit more and be better able to utilize those courts as we see what the impact is on the clerks in those offices. But I think it's a very positive story, and you probably would know from talking to your colleagues that practice in that area even better than I can tell you. But I have heard people enjoying the fact that they can take a $45,000 case to trial and get it to trial economically without having their client have to pay $40,000 in legal fees. And so I think it's been a very positive result.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Dockstader.
Mr. Chairman, Chief Justice, just so I understand, in the you referenced the caseloads are higher than staffing that's available or judges that are available. The money is there now to move people around, move judges around to meet the needs. That's already in the budget, and it's working now.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dockstader, the short answer is yes. For example, in Fremont County, where the Lander, the Fremont County Court is, I think it's 1.3 judges. I mean, they need a third of a judge. But the Judge Tyler from Pinedale is also in that district, and he takes every, I think, fourth or fifth case and is doing a lot of traveling. The other thing that's working there is the video conferencing, which he is, my understanding, is using a lot, and that's in the budget. But we do have a slight request in the area of video equipment. I'm not sure if that relates directly to Fremont County. The individual travel budgets for district court judges are in their individual budgets. I don't know of a problem there, but that's not to say that there couldn't be. I don't believe too many people travel to Natrona County and Sweetwater County to back those folks up. So the shortfall in judges is not in our budget. I mean, essentially in Sweetwater County you have two judges doing the work of almost three judges. And they're just doing it with the existing budget, but they really need another body eventually. That's not in this budget request. So where the bottlenecks are, those judges are simply putting in more hours and working harder, and it's taking longer for citizens to get through the process in those districts. And what we tend to do is sort of wait until, you know, you get at least a half a judge or you get closer to the need of a full judge before replacing it or fulfilling and creating a new district judgeship is an expensive proposition. And so I think the district court judges do a good job of trying to help each other out. They all have the individual travel budgets to do some of that, but there's probably pinching, and Judge Deegan can speak to that with greater knowledge in particular districts.
Okay, Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chief Justice, I'm just curious. I'm looking at the number of cases that the circuit courts do, and there's 118,000 traffic violations that they did, it looks like, over fiscal year 2013. And just from my experience, it appears that different counties treat traffic citations differently, and some of them send, in other words, because now that every county has a county court, they're transferring a lot of their traffic citations to county court as opposed to city or town court because it's easier and cheaper for them to do it, and they don't have to handle it. Is there any type of general way of practice or rule of thumb, or how do you handle that from a circuit court and an administrative standpoint?
There isn't a uniform. I mean, first of all, the cities and towns can make the judgment where they're going to file. And we actually had that happen in Teton County, where they concluded they could generate some money if they went into their own courts and didn't take it to circuit court. And that has pulled workloads away from that circuit court and taken it to their city town court, town ordinances. And there's no participation that we have in that process. When we moved to the circuit court system, the effort was to make it a professional, well-trained, uniform system across the state. And I hate to see it go towards more city courts. I mean that's sort of heading back in sort of to the justice of the peace direction that we came away from. But there isn't a uniform way in which that I'm familiar with. Someone else may have an idea, but there isn't a way, I don't think, that we can affect that because the statutes obviously give the cities and towns the authority to enforce their ordinances.
And then, Mr. Chairman, earlier you mentioned that in order to fix the magistrate issue, that will likely be a political issue that we have to attach by statute. Is that?
Well, yes, and we, I guess we sort of thought we did, but as we examined the statute, I don't have the language in front of me. It allows the Supreme Court to decide not to fill a magistrate position once it's open. But how do you determine whether it's open? Is it the end of the term of the magistrate that's been elected? The circuit judges in that district can determine a magistrate is not that they want to remove a magistrate. But that's a very difficult thing, too, and has not happened, I guess, is the simple way of saying that. So, you know, the counties, and we've talked to the county commissioners in those counties, and they feel very strongly about wanting a judge in their county. You know, that's more of a subjective view that it's hard to argue with. We can certainly provide them the service, and now we've got, you know, the telephone warrants and the ability to video conference and all of that, so we can provide the service, but are they satisfied if there's not a member of their community that's a judge? And that really is a political question.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Justice Kite, does the Supreme Court have any type of a review process where they look at sentences handed down by lower courts? In particular, where maybe the younger citizens have had to hire a public defender that didn't have a lot of experience and they were given longer sentences? Or do you just depend on the appeals process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, I think it's fair to say it's the appeal process that governs that kind of thing. We don't have any statewide review of the results of sentencings. The local judge has broad discretion as long as the sentence is a legal sentence and it's within the range that the legislature has provided. There is no oversight, shall you say, of the way that judges or other than the disciplinary process that you use for judges and that you use for attorneys, which obviously only deals with people who are not fulfilling their professional obligation. So I think the short answer is no, and that is something that, you know, obviously the court could take a look at and the judicial branch could take a look at along with the executive branch because the implementation of those sentences, of course, are done by the executive branch.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
And just following on with that, I mean, ultimately, as we do the rollout of the technology to have this docket system and filing system in the district courts, won't that assist both the legislature and the court in probably particularly the legislature in viewing sentences, whether they're sentences, whether it's for adult or juvenile or other things like that? That is, this technology goes forward, won't we have for the first time the ability to go back and look and try and find it and do an analysis across the districts to find out if our sentencing is doing what we think it is doing?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins, yes. We have tried to design this system in a way that will generate the kind of information that both we want and you want, and maybe the executive branch needs also. And that was not possible prior to the installation of the system. It's and I know we've struggled, and Rhonda could probably speak to this with greater expertise, to make sure that is designed in such a way that the data can then be retrieved. Not only can the legislature retrieve it for purposes of policy questions, but the district judge or the circuit judge can look at their own docket and understand how it's moving and look at trends and that kind of thing. So, yes, it will be very helpful in doing that kind of thing.
Any other questions? Okay. Anything else?
Not from my side.
Okay. I think we're ready for the budget then.
All right.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, members, again, my name is Joanne Odendahl. I'm the State Court Administrator, and I'll start with our bright green budget on page one. I realize you're all working from iPads or something today, so I'll try to go slow enough. We go through, as you say, page by page. We do start on page one with a memorandum from Chief Justice Kite, It provides you some information on recommendations for approval of budget requests. The process that we use at the Supreme Court is that all circuit judges and division administrators have to provide any budget requests to my office. Those requests are then reviewed. They're identified if it's actually needed, necessary. My recommendations are made to all five justices, and they determine the final approval to move forward. So you do see here final approvals of all the recommendations of the court. As we move to page 6, Mr. Chairman, give you a minute to go through. You do see an overview of the Supreme Court budget. Again, we have 7 divisions within the Supreme Court budget, everything from administration, judicial nominating commission, the law library, circuit courts, court technology, judicial retirement, and the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration. And I'll be going through these divisions individually. Our column 3, the budget, the standard budget, does tie to the IBAR system of the budget office. And you may have remembered in the past we've tried to use one spreadsheet that identifies the base to standard reconciliations. However, the spreadsheet got a little too large this year, so we have had to go to 2 standard reports, or 2 different reports, very similar to what the executive branch has. So right here today you have our standard exception budget request to our final agency request. On page 7 and 8, you do see a little background information of what the Judicial Department does. Again, backing what Chief Justice Kite has just said, the Supreme Court is the appellate court. The district courts have general jurisdiction, and the circuit courts have what we call limited jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court does have direct supervisory authority over the Supreme Courts, and that's why you see them as a division of the Supreme Court budget. On page 8, we provide a couple of spreadsheets for you, again, to look at our programs or division and our 7 divisions. The circuit court system is a little more than half of our entire Supreme Court budget, and the personal services, or the 100 series, is at least 73% of our entire budget. The means of funding, we do have more than $48 million of general fund dollars going to support the Supreme Court divisions, and approximately 7.2 of what we call special revenue funds that I'll talk about. And then we have federal funds of $607,455. Page 9 simply provides a summary or an overview, again, of all of our exception budget requests. And we will begin on page 10 with the administration division. Under the administration division, we have what we call 5 units, or subcategories, so to speak. On page 11.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. Jan, could you explain to me the credit card convenience fee and how that works for the $500,000 and how much it's been in the past, with a little history on it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senator Nicholas, if we could wait till I get to that unit, would that be acceptable?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Again, Mr. Chairman, we will begin with the administration on page 11 and 12. Under the administration budget, this does cover the 30 main employees of the Supreme Court. That includes the 5 justices, their 5 judicial assistants. We have 10 law clerks, 1 senior staff attorney, 3 clerks in the Supreme Court office, and 6 administrative staff members. The standard budget provides the day-to-day operations of the Supreme Court office. We are requesting a couple of exception budget requests. First, $4,000 for in-state travel to help provide and offset the cost for our staff to travel the state for not only training, but also we are looking forward in the next couple of years for our justices to meet locally with local bar associations to talk about the e-filing process. We feel it's more important for our justices to meet one-on-one rather than just simply over the phone or trying to do a WebEx. We will also do WebExes, but our justices want to talk about the e-filing process. This particular budget was reduced by over $46,000 in the last session, so we do ask that a portion of that be returned back to that budget. We are also asking for $7,500 in office equipment and furnishings. This is actually a one-time request because the code 0241 does drop out from year to year. The $7,500 would replace the five chairs that are located at the Supreme Court bench. Those current chairs are more than 30 years old, and they are literally on their last leg. They have been repaired and tried to, you know, be fixed many times, and they do need to be replaced. So,
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
If I might add the fact that we've had two Supreme Court justices retire with back problems and carrying pillows to and from the bench, so this is very important to us.
Mr. Chairman, are Supreme Court justices covered by workers' comp under this?
It's a good question. I better look into that.
Mr. Chairman, a total exception budget request of $11,500 for a total budget of $8,560,678. And you can see our spreadsheets on page 13.
Mr. Chairman?
14.
Mr. Chairman, over here.
Where are we at? Senator Perkins.
If you can go back on the clearance rates on page 11, if you could, if I understand that, are we when we look at the filings, it's just, is the clearance rate just the number of filings as, or the number of dispositions as a percentage of the number of filings is that year? Is that how you calculate the clearance rate, or is there something more to it than that?
No, Mr. Chairman, that is how they are calculated. That's correct.
Okay. Representative Stubbs.
And Mr. Chairman, just the revenue that's reflected on that same page, is that just filing fees, or is there other elements of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubbs, that is just filing fees for cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Nicholas?
While we're kind of in that direction, because there's a bill that comes up every year, could you provide just for me the number of workers' comp appeals and the outcomes of those for the last year that I can add to last year's numbers so that we can have those available when I need them on the floor?
Okay, certainly, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nicholas, we'll get that information to you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, on the clearance rate, do other states have a clearance rate as well? I'm sure they do. And if they do, do you have any way to cost-effectively look at the amount of people it takes to have a clearance rate at a certain percentage? Have you looked into any of that? Like you take, I don't like Colorado, but say you take Utah, where their clearance rate might be 95%, but they may have more staff or caseload that would show you a difference as to why. Do you look into that, or you just say the clearance rate is this and compare it to other states? Is there any way to have a cost justification in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, I don't know a way to compare staff, but we can sure look at that. The Center for State Courts has a tremendous amount of data on this topic, and I'd be more than happy to look into it in terms of staff correlations. There are other ways to determine the efficiency, if you will, of the courts than clearance rate. Clearance rate, to me, is kind of esoteric because it's just in a particular year how many came in and how many went out. It doesn't consider the complexity of the case in one year versus the other year. But the Supreme Court has adopted for its own operations internal guidelines that set time frames within which we are expecting ourselves to act, and we issued an order, I don't know, 6 months ago or so, sort of explaining that and comparing it to national standards. And for the most part, our numbers compare very well, and in some cases we're much more efficient. Some of the the work, as I was saying when we were visiting last night, that happens before the case gets ripe to be decided, the preparation of the record and the coming up from the district court and that kind of thing, I think we compare, probably looks like we could compress that if you compare us to other states. But there are lots of measurements. Clearance rate is one of them. I don't know of a staff versus clearance rate analysis, but I'll bet you, given the data that's out there, there is something, and we'll sure look at that.
Okay. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious what kind of features come on a $1,500 chair.
I am too, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, you can come and look at the sample that we have sitting in our conference room, which I haven't seen yet, but it is going to be a lot more comfortable, I'm sure, than the chairs that we're sitting in.
And Mr. Chairman, just to address that a little bit, these are considered executive-style chairs, and they do have the higher backs. the $7,500 would be the max at $1,500 per chair, but they are also more ergonomic, and you have to pay for ergonomics these days, unfortunately. But, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't think these are $1,500 chairs. At least at the end of the day, it's not telling
right.
me that.
Mr. Chairman, the chairman has $1,500.
Oh,
yeah, we do.
I think one of my committee members has mine. That's the case. Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on page 15 now, we will discuss the pro se packets. If this is another unit of the administration division. This is a special revenue fund, and what the Supreme Court does is provide packets or forms to the clerks of district court that citizens who want to self-represent themselves can go in and purchase, or they can obtain the forms from our website. And we have 10 forms or 10 packets currently, everything from divorce with children, divorce with no children, child support modifications, and custody and child support modifications. We have three packets that are in the works right now. Two will address child custody and support for those parents who have children together but were never actually married. And then also a new abatement child support. This is a special revenue fund. There is no exception budget request, but we do have spending authority of $50,000 to cover the cost of reproducing those packets and getting them back out to the clerks of district court.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. I'm just curious, what's the balance of that pro se fund?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, the balance is about $130,000 in that specific account.
And then approximately how much do you receive per year or biennium?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that number off the top of my head. The funds that we have in this account also help to cover the cost to keep those packets updated and the attorneys to review any new forms, any changes that are made by legislature from year to year. I don't have the actual amount that comes in, really, but I can certainly get that for you.
So just to be clear, can you give us a little rundown over the pack? Give us some information. Has it been spent on anything else, I guess, that fund?
No, Mr. Chairman. This specific fund is designed just to handle those pro se packets for the development, for the reproduction, to getting them out to the citizens and that type of thing.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, on page 17 and 18, you will see information on the Children's Justice Project. This is the only federally funded program that we have. This particular program works closely with DFS and the GAL, or the Guardian Ad Litem program, to make sure that abuse and neglect cases are moving quickly or thoroughly through our court system. There is no exception budget request, and our total federal grant is $607,455.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Do you have any... do you hear anything regarding whether or not this is going to continue to be funded by the federal government, or are there any rumors or decreased?
Mr. Chairman, the information we have received from Washington is that this will be an ongoing project. All 50 states are almost pushed into having this particular program. I don't want to say pushed because we do feel it is beneficial to work our district judges with the DFS offices and GAL. So we provide a majority of these funds provide training to our judges, to the GAL attorneys, and to other social workers, educators, to understand the specifics of abuse and neglect cases. So from what we're hearing, this will continue on.
Okay. Senator Perkins.
And was this a category of federal expenditures that was affected by sequestration, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, no. Actually, the individuals back in D.C., we got specific emails wanting to know, is this particular person who is the executive director or coordinator of this program, is she sequestered? And they said no, that she could continue to work. This is a grant that is given up front, and the funds were already there.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, next.
Mr. Chairman, the next on page 19 and 20, we do have the credit card convenience fee that Representative Nicholas had asked about. A couple of years ago, we started to provide a service to citizens to pay citations online. This has proven to be very beneficial. As you will see later in Christie's report on the circuit courts, we have approximately $30 million going through our circuit court system on a yearly basis. Last year, over $7.4 million did come in the form of credit card payments, which helps us take cash out of the hands of the clerks. $30 million is a lot of money. So any way we can do to also help, you know, make a convenient service to citizens, that's where we want to be headed. You may have heard of official payments. A lot of counties use that type of service. We preferred not to use that service. It was a lot more expensive. For individuals who want to pay a citation online, there is a $5 convenience fee. That fee then covers all transactions of credit cards.
Representative
Nicholas. Thank you. Could you tell us what the balance of that fund is then?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That particular balance is approximately $400,000. And again, that fund covers all of those transaction fees. Again, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the month-to-month income versus outgoing expense, but I can certainly provide that to you.
Do you know roughly what the income to the fund per year is?
I'd hate to guess, Mr. Chairman, but I will get that information to you. And again, this particular special revenue fund is only used to cover those transaction fees. It may be in the next 2 years, as we look towards e-filing, again, there will not be a cost to e-file. These particular funds, as people continue to pay by credit card or file online, these funds will pay that transaction fee.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
So I think one of the things that we're just looking at is, I mean, ultimately what you've got down here in your budget is you've got, you know, an estimated $500,000 of convenience or fees that you're going to be charged to for processing, and you're trying to have the cost to cover this. But if I understand what you just said, we've got $400,000 in the account. So something is not, you know, the idea is it's kind of a net to zero kind of thing. It should be a wash, but we seem to be ahead of the game a little bit. So I think we're just looking to see if this is the appropriate amount or should it be a little bit less. Or I think so if we could get that information, I think, you know, if we can get the actual expenditures versus the revenues, I think that would help us.
Mr. Chairman, and that is our goal. We started out with what we called an $8 convenience fee. At that time, not many people were using the credit cards. Over time, we decreased that to $5. It is now being used more frequently. So, yes, we will adjust that convenience fee again. But we also anticipate looking forward into e-filing what those costs would be, and so this may help offset those particular costs for e-filing because there will not be a convenience fee added to that particular process.
And then other things, if you can, just in general on e-citation, what effect does just looking for any kind of trends that you see with respect that are kind of a result of e-filing, are we seeing, has it relieved some administrative burden on clerks? Do we think it's a help compliance because people can pay and we're not issuing as many bench warrants? Do we see any trends like that with respect to our e-citation and e-payment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, e-citation is different than this e-pay process. But e-citations, we just met in the last few days with Highway Patrol. E-citations within the last month has finally been implemented statewide so that the officer is able to produce that e-citation. That information then is automatically transferred to the court, and it does save some time there, some efficiencies. Then once that citation reaches the court, it goes on to our website to be able to be paid online. So, yes, it does save some time overall.
Mr. Chairman, so with respect to the payments on the electronic payments, are we having more bench warrants issued or less bench warrants issued? I mean, does this convenience actually reduce the number of people who are in compliance with the obligation they have to pay fines, or do we know?
Mr. Chairman, we don't really have that data. I do believe that more people who, you know, are more transient running across our I-80 or I-25 corridors are willing to pay online to have it be a quicker process out of their life. We do still have over $12 million outstanding to be paid fines and fees to the circuit court system. I think in the long run this will help bring down those receivables. We don't really have hard data on that, though, to provide.
Okay, $12 million. Yeah, it's a lot. Okay, continue.
Okay, again, Mr. Chairman, there is no exception budget request for the credit card convenience fee unit. Total program or spending authority is $500,000. Next, Mr. Chairman, we do have the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. And again, in 2010, legislature provided an increase in court filing fees of $10, which are deposited into a special revenue fund for civil legal services for financially eligible citizens through the state. The center has, it takes, you know, some time to get up and running. We do have a handout for you that kind of gives you a few highlights that I'd like to go over. Basically, in the last year, nearly 5,000.
Just one second, I think. Oh. Let everybody grab the.
Two-page.
It's doesn't have a number on it, but it's I think it's kind of a blue second page. First page is conduct and ethics. Is that right?
No.
I thought that was the second page.
Mr. Chairman, it's titled Wyoming Center for Legal Aid, two page.
It was with the brochure that you received.
Third page. Oh, there, Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. Got it.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I just want to highlight a few things from this handout. And Angie Dorsch, the executive director, is here to answer more questions if you have them. Nearly 5,000 individuals did receive some form of legal assistance through the center. Since the center launched its website in November of 2012, more than 10,500 visits have occurred. A lot of those visits receiving legal information and resources that are available online. In November of 2012, the center partnered with Legal Aid of Wyoming to establish a hotline, which is the central point for legal advice and intake throughout the state. In June of 2013, Rock Springs area saw its first full-time legal aid attorney, which was made possible, again, by a partnership with the Legal Aid of Wyoming and also the county, which provided the facilities. In September of 2013, Gillette area now has its first full-time legal aid attorney, again, through a partnership with Legal Aid of Wyoming and the county who provided the facilities. The center has awarded more than $830,000 in grants last year, and the center continues to work with attorneys for Pro Bono Week, and just recently 50 attorneys volunteered their time to help more than 120 individuals, and the center is continuing to work with pro bono programs for Wyoming veterans. The center also worked with the Access to Justice Commission to secure a grant from the American Bar Association to develop 5 pilot remote access sites to increase legal services to rural areas who are underserved communities throughout and other underserved communities throughout the state using technology. So those are just some of the highlights that the center has provided. In this particular request, Mr. Chairman, as you will see on page 23, we are requesting 4 full-time positions. Currently, we have 4 contract employees. We do have the executive director who oversees the operations on a daily basis. We have one attorney who has developed a website and continues to work providing electronic resources. We have another attorney who provides outreach services and coordinates with the center's pro bono program, and we have one administrative assistant. We are asking simply for the positions. The funds in this particular special revenue fund are already earmarked for those contracts, and as you can see on page 24, The $490,000 would simply go from one line item or one object code of 0104 to 0103 to become permanent state employees. But just like all other judicial branch employees, they are considered at will. We do have a board that oversees all of the operations of the particular Center for Wyoming Center for Legal Aid. So, Mr. Chairman, we do ask for your consideration on the four full-time positions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nichols.
Could you explain the funding mechanism and how much, what you anticipate that fund is, first of all, how much is in it, where it comes from, what's a biannual income to it so that it's going to remain self-sufficient?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, currently there is approximately $3 million in the fund. We did take some time allowing these funds to accrue over time before we really got the center up and going. We felt it was more responsible to have the funds there, come to you, and ask for the spending authority to use those funds. The $10 filing fee has proven to be sufficient at this time. Again, the center takes a step back, and we aren't really having direct representation, but working more in partnerships with local communities to see what ideas might be out there to help individuals, maybe help themselves in providing civil legal services. So we do feel at this time that we're now asking for the $3 million spending authority that already is there. By the time we come to you in the next biennium, additional $3 million will have been accrued and go forward in that means.
So, Mr. Chairman, you receive $3 million per biennium based upon the $10 fee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Next, Mr. Chairman, we are asking for $200,000 in grants. In the last year, the center received approximately $1 million in request, but only approximately $830,000 was awarded. The board feels it would be beneficial to increase the amount available for grants, and therefore you see the request.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who were the four nonprofits that benefited from that?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like Angie Dorsch, the Executive Director, to maybe answer some questions.
Okay.
Go ahead, Suzanne.
excuse me, Mr. Chairman and Representative Esquivel. My name is Angie Dorsch, and I am the director at the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid, and it's nice to meet you all here today. The four grantees that we have provided funding for the last, 2 years has been Legal Aid of Wyoming. We have several grants with them. We separate our grants out into different programs and projects. We do have several projects. One of them is the hotline. We also have worked with them and with local organizations to partner and also provide funding with two grants, one for the Gillette office that we've opened and one for the Rock Springs office. We have also given grant funds to the Wyoming Children's Law Center, to the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and then we also do provide most of the funding for the Teton County Access to Justice Center in Jackson.
Senator Perkins.
So in the narrative we've got here, he says it's been found that leveraging the center's resources among the new and existing service providers to expand coverage and develop resources. So help me understand. I mean, so that's what you're trying to do with this $200,000 is leverage it. Help me. Can you be a little bit more specific about what the $200,000 is going to be used for?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins. What we're trying to do with the increased amount of grants is we have seen that our grant funding is able to really be leveraged across the state to be able to open new programs. And through partnerships, we've been able to make that funding go further than if we were just able to go out and hire additional staff at the center. So what we think is the best way to use those funds and be most efficient going forward is through increased grant funding so that we can have new projects like providing full-time attorneys in places that are underserved around the state, such as programs like Gillette and our Rock Springs project. So we anticipate that those funds would be used for more expansion projects.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, so I guess what you're telling me is what the $200,000 for is that you actually then contract with local attorneys that either are discounted or some rate to pay for additional legal services for attorneys to provide legal aid services?
No, actually, Senator, what we're doing with the grant funding is a little bit different than what we're using the professional services funds for. The grant funding, we actually are using most of those for full-time attorneys. We have a full-time attorney in Rock Springs and a full-time attorney in Gillette that we have used through, they're employed by Legal Aid of Wyoming, and a lot of the overhead cost and space and rent is being provided through other community organizations, such as the Council for Community Services in Gillette, and then through the Sweetwater County Family Justice Center in Rock Springs. So I anticipate that with those grant funds, we would be using that to provide probably more full-time attorneys to directly represent individuals through other organizations, such as these nonprofits that we fund.
Continue.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, again, the exception budget request is $200,000 and then the four positions for a total spending authority of $2,712,110.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
Sorry, it didn't occur to me till I was thinking about this a little bit more, but with respect to the people that receive these services, How do we determine which individuals receive service? Is there a waiting list, or is there a triage of importance or deadlines, or how do we do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, the way that we usually do it, most of the applicants that are coming in for legal aid, we're trying to get them to go through that central intake hotline because that is the most efficient way that we can provide them with advice and make sure they qualify for services. We're not using waiting lists because there's just such a high volume of eligible individuals that what we do is really a triage system, and that's what's being used pretty much nationwide with legal services to low income. And so it's basically there's priorities set out that we have set out and each of our grantees has set out. They go through and they do try to determine which cases have the highest priority to move forward with.
Mr. Chairman, okay. So what's the triage? So what gets me to the front of the line versus what gets me pushed down the list a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, most of the most important and highest priority cases are going to be the ones that there's an emergency. If there's a need, if there's domestic violence in a family law matter, if there's child abuse going on in a family law matter, also if there's a housing issue that could leave someone without housing, if they would become homeless, or if they would be evicted unlawfully, those are going to be the highest priorities, is keeping people in their housing, keeping families safe. So anything that keeps families safe and stable, those are going to be the highest priorities. We know that there's a lot of other issues that could be addressed, but those are usually the highest priorities for our programs.
Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then if someone comes in and gets a pro se legal packet, these aren't the types of cases where someone could be referred to legal aid, would they be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, these could be cases that could be referred to the center. What we see is a lot of times people do receive the pro se packets. They pick them up from their local clerk, but a lot of times they do have additional questions or they need actual legal advice more than a clerk can provide for them. So a lot of times they will call into the hotline and just get brief assistance in filling out those forms, or they can bring the forms a lot of times to one of the legal aid clinics that we provide using pro bono attorneys, and we can have pro bono attorneys help them fill out those forms and understand the process. So those are actually cases that a lot of times will find their way. If they qualify income-wise, they can find their way to one of our programs.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, I guess what you said is actually in the packet there's information for that person to access all those services.
Information about contacting the legal aid programs? I don't believe that is actually in the packet, but we do have links on our website to be able to find us, but that's something that we could think about adding as we move forward.
Okay. I think it should be in the packet, but...
We do provide information at the district course. We do have separate cards. They're not in the packets, but we do have cards that have our website address and the hotline information that the district clerks also give out. So if people do need help with those packets, they can usually call the hotline.
All right. Thank you. Next.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chairman, moving on to page 25 and 26, we have our new division of, or next division of Judicial Nominating Commission. The funds in this particular division are used to cover the reimbursement cost for the commission members to travel the state when providing the interviews for judicial vacancies. The current funds of $15,000 and $15,001 dollar. Why we still have the $1, I don't know. That's just been over time. But the current funds provide for at least 2 to 3 interviews, and as Chief Justice Kite indicated, in the last couple of years, we've had at least 11 interviews. So we are requesting $6,000 for in-state travel to be put into this particular fund. Looking forward, we are anticipating several judicial vacancies in the next 4 to 5 years. So, again, the total exception budget request is $6,000 for a total program budget request of $21,001.
Okay. Next.
Mr. Chairman, I am Christy Racines, the Chief Financial Officer of the Supreme Court. I'm going to go ahead and start on page 28, which is the next division of the Supreme Court. And that is the State Law Library. The State Law Library provides a critical, unduplicated source of legal information for the Supreme Court as well as all the district courts and circuit courts in the state. They also extensively provide services to the executive and legislative branches, members of the Wyoming State Bar, and also the public at large, really, really heavy usage by those pro se litigants. The current state law librarian is Diane Bowersfeld, and she has really emphasized statewide outreach. She has traveled the state and given presentations to many local bar organizations and other groups in order to raise awareness about the services and resources that the law library has. And actually, during her tenure so far, patron usage of the law library has more than tripled. And that's been over close to a couple of years, I think. You may remember that during the current biennium, the law library actually shouldered about $152,000 of cuts. During the next biennium for 2015-16, They will really strive to maintain those cuts by working for the most efficient and effective balance of print and electronic resources to maintain their collection. Their total budget request for the biennium is $1,398,308, and they do not have any exception requests. Moving on, Mr. Chairman, on page 32, this is an overview of our circuit court program, this spreadsheet is. Over on the left, you'll see the different categories within that program. The first five budgets, 0501 through 0505, those are shared pots of money. They're shared between all of the circuit courts throughout the state. The remaining categories represent each of the 9 judicial districts throughout the state. Okay. As you can see, I'll go into detail a little bit later, but we do have a couple exception requests in this category, one for equipment, and then there is also going to be an exception request for a position for a full-time employee in Natrona County. The next several pages give a few statistics regarding our circuit courts. On page 34, I'd like to point out the total number of filings for fiscal year 2013, which was about 179,000. On the next page,
Mr. Chairman, how do you allocate 501 to 505? Is it just based on caseload? You divide the number and send it out? Same all? How do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, they're actually not set up on an allocation schedule. It's more the pot of money is held, and then as they're needed, it is spent on those needs in the individual circuit court. For example, the first fund I'll speak to is the jury fund. So if the court in Riverton or Casper has a jury trial, it's paid out. The jurors are paid directly out of that fund.
Does that revert back to the general fund at the end of the biennium if it hasn't been spent, or does it continue to stay in there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, it does revert back. It does not pool.
And we're almost at the end of this biennial budget. How much is in that fund now?
In the jury fund?
Yeah, the 501 through 505. You probably don't know that. Just get that information for us, if you would, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. Back on page 35, I would point out that those total filings from fiscal year 13 generated approximately $30 million that came through our circuit court system. You will note on that page this is a slight decrease from fiscal year 2012. We have found that our filings correlate very strongly with the amount of law enforcement out on our streets and highways. And it's our understanding that there actually is a statewide shortage of particularly highway patrol troopers right now. Sheriffs also contribute greatly as well. So that is why we believe there is a slight decrease there.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Chairman, looking under that spreadsheet, the other party distributions, the $13 million, can you give us an idea of what kind of things are found in that line item on page 35?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, that is principally going to represent civil cases, so payments into the court and then, for example, judgments. If someone comes in and makes a small claim case, that money would come in and then be paid out to the plaintiff, and also garnishments. And any restitution.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
go, sir.
Are most of the misdemeanors traffic violations?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, I would say the majority, yes. Yes, the majority of misdemeanors are traffic violations. It would also include drug charges, DUIs.
Right.
But, yes, I would say that the majority is traffic violations.
Thank you.
Just interrupt, Mr. Chairman. I think on that prior page, it shows the number of non-traffic misdemeanors, which is 18,000, page 34.
Okay.
All right. Moving on, one remaining item before I get into the actual numbers of the circuit court section. Mr. Chairman, on page 36, you will see an excerpt from the 2013 session laws regarding the satellite courts in Dubois, Lovell, and Powell. And we have met with county commissioners, local law enforcement, and other stakeholders in those communities in order to find solutions to improve efficiencies and reduce costs in those courts while still providing service to the public at the highest level possible. And on the next couple of pages, SC 37 and 38, you'll actually see a copy of the report that was sent to you, to the Joint Appropriations Committee back in October, that describes the operational changes made in those courts in more detail.
Mr. Chairman,
and
help me out, too. I remember that we set aside a position, and we took the money, or there was some way that we were going to try to ensure this was resolved, and the drop-dead date was April, I think, of this year as to the resolution and that position. What's the status of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, that's what we're going to discuss right now. That position was removed, and we are going to request, as part of this supplemental request, that it be funded and allowed to be transferred to Natrona County. Right, is
so that's the position that we took out.
That's correct.
Before, and now you're going to ask for it. Is it the same position, Mr. Chairman, is it the same position, or it's just in the pool and Natrona County has the need? Is that how you looked at it?
I'm not sure there's a difference, but yes. I mean, it's the same position, but we want to allocate it to Natrona County.
Right. Okay.
All right, moving on, Mr. Chairman. On page 39, you'll actually see a chart depicting the staffing changes that we have made in the circuit courts based on our weighted workload study. We rely heavily on that study to really accurately tell us where our need is for clerks throughout the state. A couple of things that I would like to highlight on this page, that orange highlight, just as you just discussed, that was that position taken during this last session that was removed. And then down further, if you go down to Natrona County and look at the far right-hand column, you'll see that even after our allocations, they're 1.62 full-time clerks short, even after having allocated them a few extra clerks. That is an incredibly busy court. It's actually our busiest court in the state of Wyoming there in Casper. I'll go into detail a little bit more on that position when I get to that district.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubbs.
Mr. Chairman, is it too much to expect, or is it anticipated, I guess, that using the electronic docketing system, electronic filings, those sorts of things in the circuit court, that we'll be able to maybe help on efficiencies and I don't know if we'd be able to cut into these positions, but at least slow the growth of these positions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, I certainly hope so. And we have redone these caseload studies every 5 years, I think it is. And what it will actually measure that. Once the next time we do a study, we will have electronic filing, we will have electronic citations, we'll have the serve before filing rule in effect, and hopefully that will show in the measurements as to the number of clerks needed. I mean, it can't help but improve the situation. We can't quantify it much more than that for you right now, but that's certainly the aim.
And Mr. Chairman and Chief Justice, and I think maybe as you move forward, that is important to us, is, you know, anything you can give us as far as a correlation between our moving towards the electronic systems and what we need as far as staffing, because, of course, we've, through the last few weeks, we see millions of dollars in equipment and software and that sort of thing moving through here, and our hope and our trust is that it balances out on the personnel end. But if whatever you can give us to show us that will be helpful going down the road.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, we certainly intend to do that, and I think that we are the only governmental entity that we know of that measures this in a quantitative way, and it's we've got our eye on it like a hawk. Now, hopefully it'll produce. I mean, it just can't help but be an end result, a positive end result.
Mr. Chairman, is it an easy thing to pull out the 179,000 filings and break those down by county so you can get an idea, or that's how you do it to come up with the workload?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, that is used in the workload, that exact.
That's how you calculate it?
Yes. It's based, and like Joanne mentioned, Rhonda may want to testify to that because she's the expert, but it's based on case type, and each case type or action is assigned a number of minutes that it takes a clerk to do something, and then it's calculated out in a rather complex form to get those numbers.
I wonder if we could do that for the legislature. Especially, no. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we certainly can, Senator Bebout, provide
for the legislature?
Yeah, we can.
Careful now.
We'd love to. We'd love to. These charts that are colored, you've all seen before, we can get you, and that has every county and every kind of case filed in that county if you want to look at it.
Yeah, I'd like to see those.
Okay.
Are we good to move on?
I think we're
ready. All right, getting into the actual numbers now, our first shared budget fund amongst all the circuit courts, as we already mentioned, is on page Supreme Court 40. That is the common jury fund. We have about 90 jury trials a year in the circuit courts of Wyoming. They generally do need to call about 20 jurors a day. Sometimes it's more, particularly in these small communities where everyone knows everyone. So the cost of holding trial is about $600 a day.
You can keep going. Yeah, I don't think any of that's on the mic. Anyway.
We have found our budget of $165,209. We haven't found it to be excessive, but we have found it to be sufficient, so we don't have any exception requests in that category.
Mr. Chairman, could you tell us how much money is in the common jury fund, is it funded through an individual funding mechanism, and how do you replenish it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, it is general fund dollars. It's not special revenue, and it does revert at the end of the biennium.
I
see these guys are just rolling in dough at $30 for each full or partial day of attendance. You know, is there any thought about maybe someday we ought to at least make it halfway reasonable?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, there was some discussion about that at the Joint Judiciary Committee meeting, and the chairman of that joint committee were trying to stay on task that the management committee had given them of things to look at in the interim, and so that wasn't examined. But
yeah,
there is no question that is way, I don't know what the date that was established, but it's decades ago, and it should be looked at.
Mr. Chairman? Federal.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm sorry, Senator Meyer.
A follow up, I guess, is that, and I'm assuming that we can probably find out what some of the surrounding states are paying and get an idea,
yeah,
maybe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Meyer, we can certainly do that, and I don't know what the rate is in the federal court system, but
thank you, Mr. Chairman. More than 30. Senator Perkins.
I'm just curious because I've seen this about is there any way to know how many? Do you track how many people don't ever apply for this? I mean, I know lots of people, including my wife and I both, when we've been called to jury duty, we just never send in the voucher. I mean, it's part of it is because it's not worth the effort to get the $30. But
Mr. Chairman, there is a process that is handled as far as how the jurors are selected and then paid. But keep in mind, if you are considering to increase the jury fee, we only handle the circuit courts. The district court would be handled by your counties, and so that is an increase in their responsibility. So it's been addressed in the past, and it's been defeated because of the county expense as well.
Mr. Chairman, could you explain what the professional fees for $6,000 is for, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, that is allocated if there's any need for interpreters particularly for the hearing impaired, those funds are allocated for that purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any state that I'm going back to the jury? The $30, is there a state that reimburses anybody serving on a jury for the amount that they are missing out by not being at their place of employment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, I don't know of any. We can certainly make that query to the National Center for State Courts, and they may have collected that information, but I highly doubt it, simply because of the cost.
All right, moving on, page 42 is our next shared budget amongst the circuit courts, and that's a special fund for court magistrates. Once again, that's somebody sitting in for the judge when he is away. And I will note that each court's individual budget does have funds allocated for this purpose for court magistrates, but this is more of a contingency fund that is to be used during the extended absence of a judge if there was a medical leave or some other reason that the judge was away for a longer time and the individual court's budget was exhausted. The total standard budget request is $9,200 with no exception request.
Chairman, how much of this standard budget item for the current biennium is unexpended?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I don't have that information at my fingertips, but I can add that to our list here. The next shared fund is for equipment, and it is on page 44. There is an exception request in this category, like I mentioned before, and it is in regards to four of our circuit court offices. The circuit court in Basin needs a new coffee machine at a cost of about $12,000. Their current machine is from May of 2004. The circuit court in Gillette needs a new high-capacity shredder at about $2,600. Theirs is from February 2005. And the circuit courts in Wheatland and Riverton also need new copiers at a cost of about $14,500 and $12,200, respectively. And those machines are from August 2007 and July 2008. That makes for a total one-time request, a total exception request, of $41,449, bringing the total budget in our equipment fund to $137,019.
You know, Mr. Chairman, it's not a big deal. I'm just curious why it costs more for a copy machine in Wheatland than Riverton and Basin. It just
Mr.
It
Chairman,
ought to be the same.
Senator Bebout, we did anticipate that question, and the answer we have is these are quotes for now, and they could change over the next couple of years because it's probably at least a year out before these are purchased, but. The other answer is these circuit courts do prefer to buy locally when they can. That also really helps down the line when these machines are serviced. And so these are quotes from local office supply companies in those communities.
Mr. Chairman, and then just going back to when we started on this budget this year, and we were starting to see a lot of these agencies under the 252 series, their rental equipment, and I'm just curious why certain agencies are renting copiers and other agencies are buying copiers. And I think way back when we used to have a central copy, and I think it was in the Emerson building, but at least in Cheyenne, that for copies they had to go to the centralized copy. And I'm just curious why there's a difference between agency to agency on how they're dealing with buy-in and renting and what the difference is.
Mr. Chairman, when we put a pencil to the actual cost of leasing, the state would pay double what the cost is to purchase the machine outright. These particular offices are statewide. Even if we did have a central, I remember the days where we had a central copying office, so to speak, in supply office. These offices, unfortunately, are throughout the state. It would not be economical to send everything down to Cheyenne for large quantities of copies. But it is cheaper to purchase outright than to lease.
And just following up on that, Mr. Chairman, and a lot of the agencies that were here in Cheyenne, though, they were renting, and some of those rental agreements were actually higher than some of these purchases as well. So I don't know where we're spending the money on that.
Okay, are we ready to move on? All right, next on page 46 is another shared fund, and that is our examination of courts fund. This category funds three full-time positions, an internal auditor, an accounting analyst, and then a rover clerk. As we noted earlier, approximately $30 million does pass through the circuit courts each year. We're getting as much of that through e-pay as we possibly can, but still the overwhelming majority of those funds are cash and checks, and they're very susceptible to misappropriation and fraud. The internal auditor performs extensive audits of each circuit court throughout the state, every single county. And as she also audits the Supreme Court. And the circuit courts are kept on a two-year audit cycle. The accounting analyst provides extensive technical and accounting support to all of the circuit courts, particularly at month-end and balancing time. And then the rover clerk travels the state to work in any court which is short-staffed due to a clerk's extended leave or seasonal fluctuations, and that has proved to be really, really a critical, effective use of that position. The total standard budget for this category is $609,633 with no exception request.
Mr. Chairman, why did we go from 2 in the base budget to 3 in the standard?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, these were all positions that we had in the circuit court system, and given our weighted workload study, this rover clerk has already been there but was utilizing a different clerk position. Being that that rover clerk serves the entire state, serves all of the circuit courts, we felt that it would be more accurate to fund that position out of one of the shared categories.
So, Mr. Chairman, we'll see somewhere in your budget where you take that position away then, correct?
Correct.
Point that out when we get to it, if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious about this, the funding mechanism, since this comes out of general fund dollars. And it seems to me that maybe perhaps this is something that ought to be funded through the court systems. But I don't know what the filing fees and all those things are with circuit courts in order to finance it. But this will be an ever-growing general fund expense. So do we know what the filing fees are in circuit courts and how those fees are distributed in terms of general administration and oversight of your auditing program?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nicholas, to give you a little bit more information, the $40 court cost that is currently in effect, $10 goes to a special revenue for the Wyoming Center for Legal Aid, $10 goes into a special revenue for judicial systems automation, and $20 goes into the state general fund. We took the internal examination of the courts over from Department of Audit because Department of Audit said at the time under the executive branch that they could only provide an audit within 5 years. With $30 million going through our system and having the experienced 25% fraud in our circuit courts, it was important that we keep our courts on a 2-year audit cycle. Therefore, that's why we started the examination of courts. It has evolved over the last 10 years to include more of a desk audit as well as this rover clerk. They both help continue to provide the internal audit mechanism for our circuit court system. I don't know unless you want to consider increasing court costs, how you would actually fund this moving forward.
Moving on page 48, we have an additional shared budget category for temporary services. And this is the final shared budget category. In addition to the rover clerk just discussed, these funds may provide for temporary help when a clerk is on extended leave or to pay overtime if absolutely necessary. These funds have proved to be very useful. I looked up over the course of the last 3 bienniums, about 92% of these funds have been expended. They are really critical in the summer months in particular for some of these more tourist destinations or perhaps when Sturgis occurs, the courts up there see a large influx, and Teton County has a huge influx in the summer months. So moving on, we are going to start with the 9 judicial districts, and I would be happy to go through those individually, but what I might propose, they're all relatively standard. They're different sizes and serve different counties, but they operate relatively similarly. And if you would like, I could actually just go directly to the one with an exception request. Or would you like me to go through them individually? They're all... Okay. All right, so starting on page 50, we have the 1st Judicial District serving Laramie County with Judges Denise Now, Roberta Coates, and Catherine Rogers. Their total budget is $3,046,775 with no exception request. Page 53, we have the 2nd Judicial District serving Albany and Carbon Counties. We have Judge Robert Castor in Albany County and Judge Jane Aiken in Carbon County. Their total standard budget is $2,463,682 with no exception request. On page 56, we have the 3rd Judicial District. In Lincoln County, we have Judge Frank Thebry. In the Green River Court of Sweetwater County, we have Judge John Prokos. In the Rock Springs Court of Sweetwater County, we have Judge Craig Jones. And in Uinta County, we have Judge Michael Greer. That total budget for that district is $4,395,289. On page 59, we have the 4th Judicial District serving Sheridan and Johnson counties. In that Sheridan court, we have Judge Shelley Cundiff. She also oversees the Johnson County. And in Johnson County, we also have a full-time magistrate, Paul Jarvis. The 5th Judicial District, go ahead.
I'm just looking at the caseloads in Johnson County, and you have both a circuit court judge and a full-time magistrate. It seems like their case numbers are quite a little bit less than Sheridan County, and Sheridan County doesn't have a full-time magistrate, but just a judge.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that actually goes back to what Joanne and Chief Justice were discussing earlier, that that magistrate, that full-time magistrate, is not actually working full-time. He's paid on a formula that is part of a workload.
So, Mr. Chairman, and I'm guessing this is maybe one of the places where if you're going to do some rebalancing in your magistrate system, that you might do some rebalancing in a case like this, and would that be a correct assumption?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, if I might answer that, this is probably the busiest full-time magistrate. I think it's almost 47% or something like that of a workload. So when you see the circuit court, and there's obviously a fully loaded circuit court in Sheridan, that judge comes down to fill out the rest, essentially, of that time frame. It's the northeast corner in the Bighorn Basin where the magistrates have such a small workload that there might be some kind of adjustment. But actually, this one, you couldn't perform the work in the two counties with one judge. You really need to have that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I guess I made an incorrect assumption. I thought we had a judge in Johnson County also, but we don't. It's a shared position.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that is a full-time judge in Sheridan and a half-time magistrate in Johnson, and they help each other out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chief Justice.
Okay, and in the 4th Judicial District, their total standard budget request is $1,766,026 with no exception request. The 5th Judicial District starts on page 62. It serves Park County, where we have Judge Bruce Waters, and Judge Tom Harrington is in Bighorn County and also helps out in Hot Springs and Washakie County. Additionally, in Hot Springs County, we have a magistrate, Randy Royal, and in Washakie County, a magistrate, Ronald Jurevich. The total budget request in that district is $2,694,711 with no exception budget request. On page 65, we have the 6th Judicial District. In the Campbell County Circuit Court in Gillette, we have Judges Terrell Tharp and Wendy Bartlett. In Crook County, we have Judge Fred Dollison. He also covers Weston County. Weston County also has a magistrate, Stanley Sheehan. And Judge Dollison also does help out with the docket in Campbell County as well. Their total budget request is $3,361,041 with no exception request. On page 68, we have the 7th Judicial District, which is Natrona County. In Casper, we have Judge Stephen Brown, Judge Michael Huber, and Judge Michael Patchen. Judge Huber is retiring on February 3rd, and Brian Christensen will be sworn in on February 4th. As discussed earlier in this district, we do have an exception request. Even with the restructuring, they are still short over a clerk and a half, 1.62 positions. As we mentioned earlier, we do expect eventually to see some time saving and economies of scale from e-citations, but a lot of that is a timing issue, and we believe it will come, but it will come slowly. So right now they are still understaffed. So our exception budget request is $115,513. That would be one full-time position that would be at will, as our others are. It would cover salaries, benefits, and health insurance. That would bring their total budget to $3,651,130.
Mr. Chairman, you know, it's really hard to do it like an engineer would look at numbers, and you look at some of these circuit courts and you see that the caseload is like $140, $135 per caseload. Then you look at Natrona is already pretty high at $163, and yet we're adding numbers to that. And I guess it's just the way you do it in terms of the types of cases. Is that why it would be out of whack by 10 or 20%, or is it just an anomaly with Natrona?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, are you looking at, for example, the average?
Well, it's real simple. I take the number of cases and divide that into the budget and come up with so much per case.
Okay.
And then Natrona is higher already than some of the others, and I'm wondering if it's the type of cases they're seeing in Natrona. You know, it's just not black and white like engineers do things.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, you are absolutely correct, because that weighted caseload study is very specifically based on the case type. If you look on page 68, you will see, like I said, Natrona County is our busiest court, but Natrona County has really seen the increase from that increased civil jurisdiction. If you look between your 2011 and 2013 numbers, for example, their civil filings in 2011 were 6,280. Their civil filings in 2013 were 13,308. And those certainly are a lot more labor-intensive cases than, for example, your run-of-the-mill traffic citations.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, if you go back to 2011, you'll see the numbers are even higher, probably. That really doesn't answer the question. Are there other cases under the present scenario that's going on in Natrona that they're taking more time in your weighted average? That's how you have to get to it. Just what happened in 11 versus 12. You know, the way I would do it, I'd go back to 11, divide that into the dollars, and you'd see that the number would be way more in balance with the others.
Mr. Chairman,
we can talk about it later, yeah. But it's just a way to get to a number that I would look at it from my perspective.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, we've never done the analysis that way, and that certainly might tell us something that we don't know. But Natrona County has a higher civil docket, and I think that the economy and the downturn, which generate garnishments, which are high time consumers for the civil clerks, if there was some way to separate out the types of cases and do that sort of an analysis, we should have a longer conversation about that. That's not ever been the way we've looked at it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the downturn was 8 and 9. Mm-hmm. Maybe it took Natrona a couple of years to feel the brunt of it, but we're talking about 13 now. Anyway, we'll talk later. We got a lot to cover.
Okay, continue.
All right, moving on.
And that was the only exception request. So we'll
correct, within our judicial districts. The 8th district starts on page 71. In Converse County, we have Judge Vincent Case. In Goshen County, we have Judge Randall Arp. And in Niobrara County, we have a magistrate, Dennis Meyer, and in Platt County, we have another magistrate, Scott Cole, and Judges Case and Arp also cover both Niobrara and Platt County as needed. The total budget request in that district is $2,678,043 with no exception request.
Okay.
The final judicial district, the 9th judicial district, serves Fremont, Sublette, and Teton counties. In the Lander Circuit Court in Fremont County, we have Judge Robert Denhart. In the Riverton Circuit Court in Fremont County, we have Judge Wesley Roberts. In the Sublette County Circuit Court, we have Judge Kurt Hawes. And in the Teton County Circuit Court, Judge James Ratta. You will see on page 75, their total standard budget request is $3,805,046. And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, I would direct you to page 76, full-time employee count, down at the bottom. That is where that position dropped out and was added to the examination of courts funds.
Senator Perkins, you and I had a conversation. You thought it was another place. I guess we'll talk about that later. Maybe there's a missing person out there that's floating around.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bevout, there's actually several additions and subtractions made that were based on our weighted workload study.
Okay, just as long as the numbers add up at the end of the day.
Yes.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, that actually concludes the circuit court section. Are there any more questions regarding those budgets?
I don't believe so. So let's continue. We've got Senator Meyer's question, and just a game plan here. We can get a couple more of these probably. 10 o'clock is the break time,
and we'll
take a short break at 10 o'clock.
All right. Mr. Chairman, the only question I'd have, and this is something you can ask later, is that just looking at all of the circuit court judges and just wondering, I'm assuming you did a study as far as the demography or the ages of the different judges and stuff, and at some point in time, if you could get that back to me, I'm kind of interested in whether the legal system or the judicial system is aging out like our other employees.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we can certainly do that. Excuse me. I mentioned that we have 17 judges turning 65. I haven't broken it out circuit versus district or Supreme Court judges, but we can certainly get you those ages. And you might remember that, and I don't know why this was done, and we have suggested a couple times that we've discussed judicial retirement age, and you know that we've talked about increasing the 70, and that hasn't been successful. The statute does not provide a mandatory time frame for retirement time frame for circuit judges, and it probably should be uniform, but now it's not. And we don't have any circuit judges staying past 70 that I know of. Judge Huber just retired, and I don't know for sure what his age is, but we could certainly get you the number of circuit judges and district judges and Supreme Court judges and their ages, because it is an issue.
Okay. Can you, we've got a couple more here. I think we can get a couple before break here.
Mr. Chairman, I might suggest the next one is technology, which is going to be kind of...
Well, we're going to have to take a little time. So
why
don't we take a break?
That's
it's
what
time.
I would suggest.
We will definitely start by 20 after. We're going to say 10 after, and then it takes 10 more minutes to get started. So.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, perfect. I think we're live again. So we left off with technology.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, and we introduced Stephen Gurry. You all know Stephen from prior presentations. And
Stephen always asks for money.
We bring in our big hitters.
He's usually the bearer of good news, but he also at a cost. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As not to let the chairman down, I do have some good news. for the record, my name is Stephen Dreer. I'm the Chief Technology Officer for the courts, specifically the Wyoming Supreme Court. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. I have been asked to present the courts' technology budget request. And specifically in your budget, we will be working with pages SC-78 through SC-82. And I'd like to begin with the timeline that's on page SC-82. And for those that may be new, Mr. Chairman, in this committee, the courts have provided a timeline. I'm trying to think if it's three or maybe even four bienniums now, to be able to, as a courtesy, that fulfills two distinct purposes. The first is to illustrate the ongoing nature that multi-year court initiatives have. This provides perspective into the current and also the previous projects and resources that have been expended by this committee. The second is to provide a big picture into where technology has come from and where we are going with it as it applies to the judiciary and the courts. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to touch on what the Chief Justice so eloquently discussed in her narrative to begin with. What have we accomplished since the last time that this this committee has met together? As the Chief Justice had mentioned, 22 of 23 district courts are now deployed with their new statewide court case management system. It's called YUSER. It included various other separate efforts. It wasn't just something that one could roll into an office and turn the key or flip the light switch on. Mr. Chairman, as everyone in this room knows, the clerks of district court are elected officials. There's a certain degree of autonomy that comes with that, and that autonomy also extended into technology. And what the point of that is that technology was very disparate across our district courts. That was prohibitive when we start looking at the greater context of electronic information of the courts, things like the paperless judiciary, things like electronic filing, access to information and statistics, and also, of course, public access. To date, as I'd mentioned, we have one district court left to go live on that system. That completes a significant milestone, and it also achieves a key objective that we have had for about the last 4 years with respect to that uniformity requirement. Also, as the courts in the district level have progressed, an interesting side project has also come to fruition with respect to the electronic court record. Currently, 14 of our 23 district courts are imaging, essentially taking a paper case filing that comes across the counter, converting it to an electronic format, and then being able to store that. That has taken off like wildfire. Essentially, to put some numbers behind this, as of last week, the district courts that have imaging are currently processing 3 filings a minute. So that's all day, every day that the courts are in business. It numbered over 8,200 filings last week just in the first 14. And the reason why that's significant is because imaging is sort of is allowing us to hit the electronic filing objective running. I guess you could say that the imaging initiative has allowed visibility for judges that have pending cases on day one. With that, just another statistic for this body is that with the completion of Natrona County and their data migration and previous images, we now have over 1 million images in this docket images, I guess you could say, in the court's repository within the last year. So things are really starting to pick up on that front. We expect with e-filing that number to grow considerably. And e-filing, of course, is sort of the icing on the cake as it applies to the paperless record. It's a method of intake. It extends into the legal profession for attorneys, also with pro se litigants. It has recognized significant value to judges that travel. Those that have caseload in other courts now have access to those case files. They don't have to fax or trouble local court clerks to be able to provide that. We've basically eliminated the paper shortcoming in that regard. That's been a significant milestone for us. And the
where
court,
is, Stephen,
Mr. Chairman,
where is all that stored? Is it in your basement over here?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question, and the answer to it is that it's stored distributed. As most in this room are probably aware with technology, you never put all your eggs in one basket.
Exactly.
You don't want to leave something so that if something like a catastrophe, something happened to the Supreme Court, that data would not be at risk. And to your answer, to your point, that information is distributed. There is an off-site data center location that maintains a complete replica of all this data that we're keeping to be able to assure that that continuity exists.
Okay. Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, do you work at all in coordination with ETS or use any of their resources in the work that you've been doing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, that is a question that we get most quite often, I guess you could say. And the short answer is that we were instructed from a technology perspective many years ago, former Chief Justice, that the separation of powers included anything that could be critically reliant on a branch to be able to perform its function. And I'd like to elaborate a little bit on that. It's critical that when this body looks at the technology operation of the courts, that we're not considered just an agency. There is a branch of government behind this. There is an apples and oranges, I guess you could say, difference between the priorities that exist across the branches of government, and that plays into this as well. To Representative Stubson's point, we do keep in touch with the executive branch. The leadership over there through Director Waters, we are, for example, I've been briefed on his Uniform Network Initiative. There are things that in the future there could very well be a parallel or something to cross. The issue right now is, and for the context of today, it becomes prohibitive from a construction perspective when we have to, and maybe even this is the delicate word of priority, when one branch of government has to settle for the priorities of another branch of government, and that's the issue with e-filing, with the digital court record, et cetera. Long-winded answer. I hope
so,
I answered your question.
So you like each other, but you don't work together.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Mr. Waters and I, we do have a good working relationship. It has existed for over a decade.
Sure. I was just being a little flippant there. But yeah, we've heard that. Okay, anyway, thanks for the service.
No, quite all right, Mr. Chairman.
And we acknowledge that you're at this branch asking for money.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on, maybe that's a great segue for another win that the courts have had as of recent, since the last time we've met. The conversation has come up quite frequently regarding that of electronic citations. And I believe that Representative Stubson and also Senator Perkins asked a question earlier, where is the beef? Where do we recover some costs with this stuff? How do we start realizing some benefits? And to that, electronic citations is a very key element of that strategy, and here's why. Things that we can manage or we can measure already today is that with e-citations, we've taken a significant bite out of the manual duplicity that happens across not only the courts but other organizations. So what's that mean? If I get a citation, it's a piece of paper that has five duplicates. A duplicate goes, of course, to the court. One goes to the offender. Another one goes to the Department of Transportation, where they, too, have to have somebody fat finger that information in. With electronic citations, you've eliminated that potentially four times. Additionally, you've increased the accuracy of information that's coming from law enforcement at that particular time. We don't have clerks that are trying to decipher or recognize an officer's handwriting at that point, or maybe the officer put incomplete information. It happens all the time where you would see potentially a charge would be levied against an offender, and they might have used the wrong title in the statute. Things like that are addressed with these citations. Additionally, another key value, I guess you could say, a big win for the state of Wyoming is how that information is shared. With e-citations, and this goes well beyond just citations, but when this information is electronic, it's imperative that it be shared, that we allow other organizations that have a vested interest in that to be able to participate in that discussion.
Senator Meyer.
And directly to the point of sharing the information, I think there was a bill several years ago that prohibited insurance companies for using information as far as speeding tickets that were 10 miles an hour over the speeding limit or less to change their rates, or wouldn't be public information. And now that we're in this electronic age, I'm wondering what safeguards are in effect to basically
you know, be in compliance with that statute.
I think we all have constituents that want to know that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that question does come up quite frequently. In the context of sharing information for today's purposes, I'm explicitly referring to other state organizations. Here's an example of that. Department of Transportation Driver Services, there is a process of adjudication, particularly as it applies to the disposition of citations. They receive that information electronically. That's the sharing with DOT. There is a criminal justice aspect to information, particularly as it applies to the Division of Criminal Investigation. Again, criminal information and non-criminal for that matter with YCGIS. One may have heard of that particular electronic program before, and so the courts participate. To the senator's question about how is that information secured, at this point, the vast majority, and I can't think of one that would not be under this, is that there's a memorandum of understanding drafted with each respective agency that explicitly defines what the particulars are for sharing under the terms of that agreement and how that information can be used.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, another thing, we're still on the electronic citations, if you will.
Sure.
And I'm kind of rolling off along what seems to be a long laundry list of benefits. And if it seems quite long, it's because the e-citation conversation has been ongoing in Wyoming for almost two decades now. So there has been a lot of benefit realized with this, and I think it's important to share it with this group. Specifically, another thing that kind of happened, and this is difficult to quantify, through the initiative that we had with e-citations, primarily with the Wyoming Highway Patrol, that's the statewide entity that the Chief Justice had mentioned that we are already live with today. 100 officers out of approximately 150 are capable now of issuing electronic citations in the circuit courts. The benefit has been to get the judiciary, our half of that information agreement, if you will, that sharing process, that transaction electronically. We had to get our ducks in a row to be able to accept citations. And so that is a key benefit with us as it applied to e-citations today. So as we put on our glasses of foresight to look down the road, it obviously goes into local law enforcement. And many of the challenges that have occurred or that have been prohibitive with even the adoption of e-citations that resided on the court side of that fence, if you will, have been resolved as of to date. Joanne actually mentioned a statistic that I was going to as well, and that is that when you look at the citation process.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me for interrupting, but you said it had been resolved as of this date. Tell me what the issues were and how resolution was accomplished.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, just to clarify, your question is, what are some of the hindrances that we've run into with these citation adoption?
Right, you made the comment that we've had these problems and these issues. I want to know what they were, and then you said they've been resolved,
yep.
And I want to know how you resolved them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A good issue would be that of standardization of data. In particular, if there are little caveats between law enforcement agencies where they're not collecting apples to apples or it's difficulty for the court to relate, we had to be able to accommodate that. So standardization is one. Uniformity is another. There has been aspects which relate to the way that the courts actually handle these citations. So you're dealing with policy at that point, court rules, even the statutes. All of these things have sort of vetted out the any sort of hindrance that the courts would be bringing to that table. Did I answer your question, Mr. Chairman? Okay. Getting back to the electronic payments aspect of this, it's been touched on that, of course, just like anything else with technology, payments are no exception. In the calendar year 2013, the circuit courts processed $7 million in change of electronic payments. A vast majority of those were citations. And it gets a little bit kind of hairy in the numbers at this point, but there are other benefits as well, such as the ability for an individual to be able to pay their citation immediately, and that takes a dent out of the uncollectibles that could be potentially building up if people are waiting for paychecks, et cetera. And lastly, as it applies to e-citations, another benefit that may not be quite so prevalent is that of improved officer safety. Now, this is not necessarily something that directly benefits the courts, but it's certainly one to our partner agencies. Essentially, what e-citations allows is it allows an officer to go through the citation process much faster, particularly as it applies to multiple citations. That individual is no longer standing at the side of the road or working at the side of the road where the conditions are dangerous to an officer. And Mr. Chairman, that's basically the heart of my introduction. If there are no questions, I'd like to move into the actual budget.
Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just went and logged on to it, and it says that you have to put in a case number, citation number, or driver's license number. So then, is that if the officer fat fingers the citation number and it doesn't match up with the e-ticket you have, that when you punch in your driver's license, your citation's going to pop up on this next screen?
Mr. Chairman, what Representative Esquivel is referring to is the electronic payment, what we call Gateway. It's essentially a website that any offender that's received a traffic citation can go and adjudicate their citation through what's called a forfeiture. In other words, we can take the money and the case can go away. How it works is we have to this kind of gets into the technical weeds, so I'll address it very topically. That citation is issued. There could very well be some fat fingers errors if it's a paper citation. Maybe there is a numeric transposition on the driver's license number, etc. That information would not be available for payment simply because of that issue. And that website that you're referring to says, if that has a problem, please contact the local court so that that clerk can maybe resolve the issue or take the payment at that point. With e-citations, that issue becomes moot, if you will. And I say that because there are other things that can be tied to e-citations, such as a card swipe. The system automatically recognizes all of the person information on the front of the driver's license and pre-populates that, so the officer doesn't have to key it in. That dramatically improves the data handshaking, if you will, to be accommodative of electronic payments. Mr. Chairman, for the duration of our exception budget request, I'd like to draw your attention first to page SC-79. And as a quick background, and one can, of course, parse through the narratives and refer to the timeline and whatnot. Essentially, any of the requests that are in this particular budget are in color on the timeline, and they correspond to how the courts, I guess you could say, differentiate as we have assigned a priority to each one of these things. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to begin with Exception Budget Request Priority 1 on page SC-79. It's the current and ongoing technology core operations. The key highlights from the narrative, Mr. Chairman, include that this is essentially items that are subject to a one-time purchase. This includes computers, tablets, printers, data center equipment, infrastructure, and single software purchases. Mr. Chairman, this particular request is broken apart by jurisdictional district, with the Supreme Court appellate being one, of course our limited jurisdiction courts being another, with the circuit courts and general jurisdictions with district court. Are there any questions with this particular priority?
Just real quick, I mean, usually we see how many, the types maybe of devices, what kind of rotation schedule you're on. I mean, mm-hmm. We've seen everything in state government from a couple years to 5 years and some longer. And so maybe some of those, and if you could answer those now, did you have a similar question, Representative Stepson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Harshman, I can certainly offer a little bit of visibility into these numbers. With the circuit court equipment, the primary line item or the cost that's most significant, and if you'd like explicits like the number of machines, et cetera, it varies by jurisdiction. Some are a little bit more difficult to forecast. But as it applies to the circuit court, these are workstations that the clerks have been using for almost 7 years now. The issue is the reason why we're upgrading them at this point is simply because they've been dropped from support by the manufacturer. Mr. Chairman, a way to kind of look at it in terms of the court's methodology with equipment replacement is drive it until just before the wheels fall off. And so that we try and get as much bang for our buck, but at the same time, we don't want to be exposed to the risks of having computers die and there's just not funding available to it. Mr. Chairman, at the district court jurisdiction, the requests that come in for technology equipment are up to the discretion of each local judge. That poses a certain challenge, if you will, to be able to forecast what will be requested the next biennium. They are, however, subject to at least 3-year minimums on the retention of equipment. As new things come into play, such as real-time court reporting, there could very well be an additional workstation needed at that level. Things like tablet computing, et cetera, play into all of this. At the appellate – oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, at the appellate level, the Supreme Court equipment, it's key to point out that line item is significantly more simply because we maintain most of the critical infrastructure of our technology operations at the appellate court level. Significant expenses within that line item include data storage costs, servers, infrastructure, things of that nature that impact not only the appellate court but all of the subsequent limited and general jurisdiction courts as well. That's why that line item is significantly more. Mr. Chairman, are there any other questions?
Representative Moniz, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said this is a one-time request.
Correct.
I didn't know there was anything electronic that was a one-time request. How is it a one-time request?
Mr. Chairman, I think the appropriate answer for that is that based on what I had mentioned earlier, where we'd like to run these things until the wheels fall off, but knowing full well that there could be a potential that there could be a failure in the middle of that. And so that's why it applies to one-time equipment replacement as opposed to something every 3 years. We wanted to make sure that we covered the base, had the funds available. Ms. Odendahl?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moniz, basically the category that these pieces of equipment are going to be purchased from, the O242, only happens for one biennium. It does not become part of the standard budget. And so, therefore, again, it's a one-time request. It's not expected to have these particular funds included in every biennium request.
Similar to the way we run our executive branch, I guess. But the thing that, you know, we'd like to see, I think, is really the numbers of machines, types. You know, it's helpful to tell us the replacement and that. I guess the other piece of the three-year minimum, the Supreme Court's subject to that three-year minimum as well.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe that the Supreme Court is subject to any other great wide minimum, if you will, statewide minimum, that is. This is just something in terms of consistency that we've adopted.
Any other?
Mr. Chairman, moving on, I'd like to draw your attention to priority number 2 in our budget. That is on page SC-79. That is the Supreme Court Learning Center. The Chief Justice did, as I mentioned earlier, a fantastic job of introducing this subject. I know that Mr. Chairman, some in this room have had the opportunity to come and take a closer look at what this request is actually doing. Referencing the handout that was provided with respect to the Learning Center, the project is broken apart into multiple phases. And this particular request comes at phase 2, I guess you could say. And as was mentioned earlier, technology has a striking prominence in these education centers through the interactive kiosks or the displays. Like it or not, most of the content nowadays is actually being delivered through technology. And this appropriation simply provides the funding necessary to be able to implement the technology.
So this amount, $280,000 requests, there's obviously other pieces. There's a capital construction piece to this. You're going to have to do something to your floor and some electrical and a wall and those kind of things. Where's that request at? Is that another part of the budget? Or?
Mr. Chairman, what we are doing currently is waiting to see what the final bid is from the contractor who actually redid the remodel of the interior. We are hoping to come up with sufficient funds within our current biennium budget to pay for the cost of installing a wall.
Mr. Chairman,
well, any thoughts where that's coming from your current, instead of reversions, then you just...
Mr. Chairman, yes. Basically, I don't know if you recall, 2 years ago, we provided the Hayes study funding of $54,000 out of our current budget, even though we were not ever provided those funds. We came back last year and asked for those funds to be provided to us, along with funds for the weighted workload study. The weighted workload study came in a little bit under budget, and so we do have a few thousand dollars to cover the cost of that wall.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Who was that? Senator Doc Satter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Justice Kite referenced some grants when she did this introduction a little earlier today. Where do those fit into this budget?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Doc Satter, the grants were hopeful. Well, obviously, we don't have them yet, but they would go towards providing the infrastructure and the additional displays that we want to do on the wall. We're working with the State Museum to try to come up with ways in which to display significant events in Wyoming legal history and things like the, you know, things that would be of interest to anybody coming through that doesn't know much about the law, and that's where we would use that money. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot of times when we do these kind of initiatives, you know, we look at matching grants and we look to the private sector and different things, and this is a kind of a start, and I can see if this gets started that there's going to be a lot more money needed down the road. And certainly when we looked at it last night, it's something that should be considered. If we just said it's matching money to get it started and something like that, I know we've got the cultural trust. I mean, we got a lot of different state programs that I don't know why we couldn't go to some of those people and ask for grants to come in and do this, because it's for the overall, you know, the overall image of our state relative to that building. And, the you know, it's just a neat building. What if we did that? What did that do to your program? I mean, it's always nice to have all the money and we give it to you. But what would that do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Viebout, because we, first of all, we're a little bit limited. We've got to get, I mean, the courts can't go out and raise money from, you know, Exxon
or
whoever.
But you can go to the Cultural Trust
Fund. Oh, yeah, right, and we plan to. We plan to go to the Cultural Trust Fund. I've had some initial discussions with the L. Bogan Foundation and other foundations like that that are dedicated to education. But those are certainly not in the bag. And we need enough to be able to sort of get things started in order to attract the grants. So I understand what you're saying. I think it would hamper us quite a bit if we had the whole thing had to be matching funds. If we can use some portion of it without having the matching funds already secured, that would be preferable, because we just, you know, it's just unknown, I guess, as to when and how and how much we might be able to get from a matching. But the whole point would be to try to use this, because it would be the leverage.
The other thing, Mr. Chairman, is I'd be real curious as to what it will ultimately cost in the plans that you presented to us, what that number really is.
Well,
and if you could provide that to us, because, you know, these have a way of growing and expanding. And I mean, if we're going to have it, if we buy into it, not saying we will or won't, but if we mm-hmm. do, we'd like to know down the road so we don't be surprised by another exception expanded budget with this whole thing, what cost to get to where you want it to go.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Viebout, we can certainly try to do that. It's difficult to do, because when you say what it costs, we have to define what it is. And
well, that's up to you.
Yeah, I know, and we don't have that completed at this point in time, but we can try to put...
Well, if we don't have it completed, then maybe we should wait till we know exactly what we're getting into.
Well, that's an option for this committee. We would like to move more quickly on that front, because we've got the access to the Colorado information and we've got the momentum, I guess, is what we've got right now. If we wait until the next legislature, or certainly the next budget season, it just puts off the benefits that much further. So I think the thing that might be more attractive is to stage it, and you know, you authorize a certain amount of money this time around, and we come back and show you what we've done, and if it's something you agree with, you authorize more the next time around. But we can try to put a ballpark on our wish list. If we could get all the money that we think would do, you know.
I'm not looking for that necessarily Mr. Chairman, but I think if you're going to stage it and there's a responsible way, I'd be interested in seeing that and what you're looking at that might make sense and where you'd like to end up.
Okay.
Is it a two-year program?
Yeah,
is it a six-year deal? And where you'd like to be?
Kind of include all the costs to this little small Capcom piece, this kind of how much for the monitors, boom, boom, boom. Give us an itemized kind of roll out of this so we can kind of see and what you want to start with and maybe what you want to get to.
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly do that, Senator Viebout.
Thanks.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, following up on that a little bit, a lot of the numbers that actually went into the line item that's presented to you today came off of the Colorado cost sheet. So, in other words, the kiosks, the interactive displays and whatnot that apply to technology, we took a play from their playbook. And so most of those are pretty well right on the money as it applies to this request. As the Chief Justice had mentioned, the difficulties in forecasting matching, if another agency or some other organization is going to be in competition with grant funding, we don't want to have a kiosk that's open to that. In other words, where there's a potential that it couldn't happen because we're betting on the grant funding.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that, but that's mm-hmm. the real world, and that may very well happen. And, you know, you'll have to do that if that's where we get to. And you know, I'm not so concerned about how much it costs per kiosk. I'm more concerned about conceptually where you really would like to see it go. so we're not surprised in what we're looking at, and you know, down the road. Mm-hmm. So I think we've talked enough about it. If you could provide that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Certainly.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, in conclusion, for priority number two, we're seeking a one-time exception request of $280,000. If there are no questions, I'd like to move on to priority number three, which is on page SC80 of our Supreme Court budget, statewide juror management. Mr. Chairman, as a quick background to this particular budget request, ultimately it began with a discussion that the courts had with the Joint Judiciary Committee in Lusk. Specifically, there were three points of interest that that committee brought to our attention. One was, of course, one may be already apprised of this, but one is to update the archaic language that exists in our state statutes as it applies to juror selection, procurement, acquisition, etc. A good example of that is to shake the box in terms of randomization. The second area of interest was to fix what I'm calling a technology sensitivity with respect to jurors in low-population counties. Essentially, what was happening in a nutshell is that potential jurors were being summoned from multiple jurisdictions of courts, and there was no coordination across that. And so if I'm an individual in a sparsely populated county, there's a potential that I might be summoned for jury duty multiple times, maybe in a year, maybe across double courts, maybe sequential. It was difficult to tell. And so the Joint Judiciary directed, at their direction, we have addressed that problem. And lastly, the third area of interest as it applied to that committee is the meat or the genesis of this request. And that is specifically, what are other states doing as it applies to juror management? I can tell you that I have done quite a considerable amount of research as it applies to this. States that I have acquired basically requests for proposal information and also vendor procurement include the states of Oklahoma, New Hampshire, and North Dakota. And a specific, I guess you could say, requirement that has been prevalent throughout all of this is we have to look at juror management from a statewide perspective, meaning one solution that is capable of servicing all of the local needs of courts. And with that, that discovery process also brought to light certain key issues that exist currently in Wyoming. And of those issues, as it applies to anybody that has served on jury duty, is one is the accuracy of information. Mr. Chairman, a great example of that is individuals that are deceased. There is not really an easy way to be able to go through and parse through the list of eligible jurors from those that have been deceased, particularly if the death certificate originated in another state. There's just no way for Wyoming to be sensitive to that. To put a real-world number on that, this is somewhat anecdotal in that I don't have all of the courts represented, but as it relates to how difficult is it to find people in Wyoming? In some of our busier courts, like, for example, here in Laramie County, almost 40% of all jury summons and questionnaires come back as undeliverable mail. You're dealing with a very high percentage of the inability of the courts to be able to know where people are, to be able to serve them or give them a questionnaire to be able to get them on jury duty. Essentially, that plays into a considerable amount of this particular request. The list of solution providers that actually get into jury management, not to bore the committee, is very minimal. There's only about one or two different key players that have, one, ever done it successfully in another state. So we would be able to benefit basically with a turnkey application. One of the services that is provided by these vendors is they can actually look up person information through a national registry, like the United States Postal Service. So if there's been a change of an address of a potential juror and they haven't updated their driver's license and voter registration doesn't know about it, this particular entity can say, well, maybe there's a change of address to the post office and be able to accommodate that, thus saving the courts considerable costs and duplicity of multiple summonses and questionnaires. Another benefit, I guess you can say, that third-party or commercial tools that become available to jurors, I'm currently serving on a term for the federal jury duty. I have to call in every Friday, and I have to see if I have to serve the next following week. I was able to complete my jury questionnaire online. And I'm able to, like I said, use the automated tools that the federal courts use to be able to report for jury duty. There's a convenience factor there. Essentially, there are other tools that offer the same level of convenience that could be adopted in Wyoming through these commercial providers. Again, I mentioned the online questionnaire, phone reporting, electronic reporting for duty, so I know exactly, instead of having to call a phone line, I can actually see it on my tablet. And lastly, as I mentioned earlier, the bulk mailing problem that deals with a lot of the undeliverable mail. Mr. Chairman, are there any questions related to this request?
Questions?
Continue. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm seeking a one-time exception request for $656,000. Mr. Chairman, moving on, priority number four, as it's identified in the Supreme Court budget, is on page SC-80. This is the Circuit Court Judicial Video Appearance Network enhancements. For those that may not be acquainted, what the video appearance is simply another way of saying we are implementing video conferencing in our circuit courts. This has recognized many benefits in those courts that have particularly implemented this technology, notably for the circuit judge to be able to accommodate individuals that are incarcerated. So you've got Monday morning arraignments coming through, and they have to have prisoner transport. So that takes deputies off the road to be able to protect and bring these individuals sometimes across the street from the jail, sometimes across town from the jail. And there's a significant expense that video has been able to offset in the places where that's used. Mr. Chairman, as a brief update on this technology, as it's been deployed, first it was in the district courts. We addressed every county seat. Now we're looking at the circuit courts. Together with the appellate court, we have almost 44 endpoints that are currently on the court's video appearance network. 23 of 23 district court counties, as I had mentioned. We're currently looking at 22 of 29 circuit courts with video capability. That number is a little bit murky because some courts share a courtroom with district court that has that capability. A good example of that would be Wheatland and Platte County. Mr. Chairman, the milestones as video has been applied in the courts has been numerous. We've been doing this for almost 4.5 years now. We've held everything from routine court hearings, as mentioned, to remote witness testimony. We've had the elimination of prisoner transport, as I mentioned. We've held board and commission meetings, town hall meetings. And just recently, Mr. Chairman, we held an entire district court judges conference by video. That particular video call included 14 district locations and also hosted three legislators as guests. Mr. Chairman, this particular priority number four covers there's a request sufficient to cover endpoints in three additional circuit courts. It is a one-time exception request of $36,750.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, what do you have those circuit courts already designated that would benefit from this appropriation of the three additional locations?
Mr. Chairman, I do. My notes say that the circuit court in Newcastle, in Evanston, and also Worland would be the three items.
Mr. Chairman,
with
regards to the videoing, how do we know how much it's being used and in what areas it's being used? Is it an hour a week? Is it 3 hours a week? Is it every day? I mean, is it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, that's a great question. That information comes to us in multiple forms. We hear about it, of course, from word of mouth, from judges that are using it routinely. We hear about it, or we can quantify it in the context of reporting. The system is an enterprise-level system, and so what that means is that every single video call that occurs, we have a date, a time, and who the participants were on that. So we have a really good idea of who's using the system. The caveat, I guess you could say, is that different judges use it for different purposes. If I'm a judge that has to travel routinely to another county to be able to hear routine hearings, and I can implement video, that puts that judge's usage at a much higher rate than, say, somebody that doesn't have to travel as much. And so you have to be careful with how that's distributed when you look at those numbers. The short answer is thousands and thousands of calls have occurred with this.
Mr. Chairman, do you have a breakdown of what the calls are for and how much are actually arraignments or appearances versus...
Mr. Chairman, at this time I don't have that kind of granular visibility within that. I can basically tell the endpoints that were involved. I couldn't tell you the nature of the content or what those proceedings were.
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question about the remote witness testimonies. When we were in Casper, we went to the Child Advocacy Center, and they had the forensic interviews. Maybe Representative Stubson could elaborate a little bit more on that. But these were the child exploitation cases or sexual assault cases. Are you using those types of cases with this type of witness testimony as well?
Mr. Chairman, I want to be sure that I understand the question correctly. Representative Escobar, are you inquiring as to whether or not video technology is for, like, expert witness testimony?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, the likeness and nature of testimony, I think, varies, and it varies because of the judge. For example, I can tell you that in Wyoming, with regards to juvenile hearings in particular, a good example is like the girls' school, the boys' school, the boys' home, etc. That could be considered remote witness testimony as well. I have been informed that participants that are incarcerated in federal penitentiaries have also been dialed up, if you will, through the U.S. Attorney's Office to be able to facilitate. Maybe that individual was a parent of somebody here or knew something that was relevant to a case. It's really difficult to say this is how it's being used for primarily and secondarily, et cetera.
Just to follow up, that what we heard up in Casper was that when defendants saw this videotape, they usually plea bargain their cases and didn't end up in court.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, are you referring to the content that would be displayed, for example, child pornography?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I think your question, Representative Escobel, is if you had the expert testifying in that fashion, that then the defendant would plead, and that certainly, I'm sure, has happened. We've got some district judges here that could tell us how they have used it in their individual cases. I have certainly heard anecdotally that expert witnesses is one of the usages, because they charge so much to come, you know, from the East Coast or the West Coast or wherever they are to a particular trial, so it reduces the cost for the parties involved, and if the state is a party, it certainly reduces the cost for a state. But you've all participated in it. You know, there's a little bit of a delay for meetings. It's not, maybe not quite as effective as being face-to-face, but when you're talking to one person, it is very effective and has been utilized that way. We could certainly survey the district and circuit judges and find out more about exactly how they're using it, but I know they use it for arraignments, and they use it for depositions, and they use it for testimony and other fashions.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Justice Kite. One further comment on that, a good example of how that's used routinely for remote witness is the chemical testing lab here in Wyoming. They are routine participants in circuit courts. I have heard, again, this is just anecdotal, that oftentimes that knowing that they will be testifying may result in some certain plea bargains, agreements, and that kind of stuff. It may even act as a deterrent. Okay. Mr. Chairman, moving on, I'd like to draw your attention to priority number 5. This is on page SC81 of the Supreme Court budget. It's called Courtroom Technology Enhancements. And to highlight the key points of this particular request, Mr. Chairman, one may be familiar that we have been retrofitting and going through a lot of the district courtrooms, circuit courtrooms, et cetera, statewide for quite some time now. The reasons for doing so are quite numerous, everything ranging from new courthouse construction to a judge request, accommodations for hearing impaired and ADA compliance, etc. What this particular priority goes into is that we want to make sure that the money is available when those requests come up in the next biennium. Specifically, this funding would go towards the implementation of either audio, video, both. Also, digital audio recording, etc., up into 5 courtrooms. Mr. Chairman, this one's pretty cut and dry. Are there any questions?
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious why these wouldn't come through into the individual district courts for request for appropriations or one-time funding, as opposed to go through you. Is there any?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, the reason for that being is that by and large most of these are conversations centered around technology. Mr. Chairman, the other issue is the uniformity. We want to assure that every district court or every circuit court has similar tools, that they are capable of performing the same function, and in order to be able to assure that uniformity, that's where it was delegated here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd pose the question to the district court judges here. It seems to me you would rather request it and have control of it versus having the Supreme Court control it for you, but I don't know what your position is on that, and or whether or not you can speak to it.
Well, we won't. We'll hold that thought for a little bit. Okay. Any other questions? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that priority number 5 for the courtroom technology enhances, we're seeking an exception, a one-time exception request of $300,000.
Okay.
Lastly, that brings us to priority number six, which is found on SC 81 of the Supreme Court budget. It is in regards to electronic citation grant funding. Mr. Chairman, as a quick background to this, the last biennium that we appeared in front of this committee, we spoke quite at length about the electronic citation adoption. And in the context of the grant funding, I guess if you can say, it involves local law enforcement from the sheriffs and chiefs of police. What is brought to our attention repeatedly is an apprehension to adopt e-citation as cost. Mr. Chairman, most in this room are pretty familiar with costs that come in as an initial lump sum, and then, of course, the continuing costs in order to be able to keep the technology in place. In order to address that concern with costs, the Supreme Court came to this body with a request to be able to have some money available with a matching process to enable local law enforcement to adopt this technology. Because of the greater e-citation effort at large, that has moved slower than we had anticipated. As of today, I have two unofficial requests by local law enforcement that would like to apply for this grant. We have not seen the official paperwork yet. And the reason why we have this particular allocation in addition to the one of the prior biennium is simply one of disclosure. Mr. Chairman, not all of these funds have been allocated. We want to remit them back to the state and then request them so that they become available in the very near future. Specifically, as the Chief Justice had mentioned, e-citations, we're at the precipice of this taking off. We want to make sure that the money is available for local law enforcement, et cetera.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Co-Chair.
Could you provide us the amount of money that's in that account and which you anticipate reverting?
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to provide that information. At this time, we don't have, as I've mentioned, the official request from these local entities at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a disconnect, if I may,
yeah.
Senator Beebout. We haven't spent any money out of this account.
That's correct.
So because we had to get the Highway Patrol on board and operating before we could start offering it to sheriffs and chiefs. So you authorized $1.5 million last year, and it hasn't been spent. It'll revert back. We'd like to get it reauthorized because now we're ready to provide it to the sheriffs and chiefs.
That's what I was looking for, that paper trail. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
If there are no further questions on that.
I don't believe so. Continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we're seeking a one-time exception request for electronic citation grant funding of $1.5 million. Mr. Chairman, that brings our total exception request for the upcoming biennium to $4,029,400.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
I
have a question on the e-citation grant funding. Is it a matching grant? Or do you have developed how it's going to go? Or is it first come, first serve once you have the funds? And then, you know, if you give $1.5 million worth out, then are you going to come back and ask for another $1.5 million? Do you have a plan on it?
Mr. Chairman, the short answer to that is yes, we're looking to maximize these funds. And a way to do that is to draw ownership from the local county that's applying for these things, so that's where the match comes into play. As it applies to down the road, that's very difficult to forecast. As I'd mentioned before, there is an ongoing cost that's associated with this stuff. This grant is not to be covering the cost of that ongoing expense. This is more or less seed money to be able to get over the hurdle that local law enforcement has raised repeatedly with respect to initial costs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Escobar.
I did have a question back on priority three that just kind of came up to me. On your juror management, will that system kick out a juror that had been repeatedly chosen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, the short answer to that is yes. And that is a part of one of the concerns that was brought up by the Joint Judiciary is how do we address that so that the ongoing nature, people felt inundated with service, and so we're using technology to address that.
And Mr. Chairman, you look kind of surprised when you got through Priority 3 that there were no questions on that. So.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Hey,
sure.
Don, would you go back? I was trying to find it and couldn't, and find where we had the money, the $1.5 million last year, and we took it out. And just give me the paper trail on that. I can't find it. Thank you.
Don?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the $1.5 million wasn't taken out, right?
Well, that's, Mr. Chairman, that's what the Chief Justice said. I thought that we, you know, it's going to revert. It was in the budget. It's going to revert. I just want to figure out where it was in the budget and how it all tracks.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we'll work with Don and do that. It wasn't taken out. We just haven't spent it, so it will go be reverted if we don't re-request it.
Okay.
So it's a net zero effect, and that's, I just want to have that paper trail.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I've got one other question. I don't know if it was addressed earlier, but it looks to me like the and Don, you might want to help me with this. The you had budget reductions of $662,000 from the judicial branch, and with the salary increases and agency derived increases, it's about $102,000 over that. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you're getting at is last year during the supplemental budget session, the legislature appropriated $600,000 for compensation increases that would be ongoing. As a result of that, that number would double, we would expect, to $1.2 million. By our analysis, it appears that it doubled plus some, which means that the agency had to have used internal resources to increase salaries to the tune of $102,000 in excess of the $600,000 that was appropriated by the legislature. So that gets wrapped into their standard budget at a higher level than what was originally appropriated in the supplemental session.
And so my question is, do you have a response to that, or is that your number is consistent with ours?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do agree with Don in that. And actually, you do have a handout that we are pulling because I was under the impression that not all of the $600,000 had been implemented or, you know, handed through. But according to the numbers, when we include the clerk, the district courts, the judges' offices, it does work out. So, yes.
Okay. Okay, next.
Next, Mr. Chairman, to make it clear, what you just heard from Stephen on the court technology unit was general fund dollars. Now, on page 85 and 86, we start the judicial systems automation account, and that's where that extra $10 court fee goes into the special revenue fund. The total standard budget is $3,949,352. There's no exception budget request.
Okay.
I do want to point out that this is where the staff is paid from and the day-to-day operations to keep all three divisions of the Supreme, District, and Circuit Courts going on a daily basis.
Okay.
Next, Mr. Chairman, on page 87 and 88, we have a judicial retirement fund. And this is what we consider to be the original retirement program that was in place for Supreme Court justices and district judges who were appointed prior to July 1 of 1998. Since that time, there's a new, what we call a new judicial retirement fund, and that is handled by the retirement office. This is an unfunded liability account that has to be requested every biennium to be provided to those judges, spouses, whatever the situation might be, who were, again, appointed prior to July 1 of 1998.
Yep. Senator Meyer.
Yeah. I apologize. Could we back up to page 86? I know we've got the 900 series of professional fees, and we can look at the detail on that. But the external maintenance contracts, 0292, do we have any specifics on that anywhere in a handout that you can draw my attention to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I don't have detail with me today. Maybe Stephen can address. We have different continuing. We have internet maintenance. We have... Stephen, I don't know if you can.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman, why it's not in a 900 series, or because it's external, why it's in the 292 series. That's I don't quite understand that function there, the 292 And I apologize, I'm just not familiar with the 292 series on in that.
You think that's what it is?
I don't want to speculate. Okay. Mr. Chairman, we would have to dig for that information to provide that level of specificity. We would be happy to do so, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, going back to judicial retirement, the standard budget is $2,313,196. There is no exception budget request.
Mr. Chairman, just for my information, and I see there are spouses in there, are you treated the same as the other retirees in the state of Wyoming in that regard, or are spouses treated different for the judicial retirement system?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, under this particular retirement fund, the spouse is eligible for either 50% or 100% of the benefit that particular judge was receiving. Now, keep in mind, under the statutes, the most a judge retiring under this program would be 50% of an acting judge salary. It is not as, lucrative as the big new judicial retirement plan that is in place under the retirement system. The max anyone could ever receive is 50% under this.
Mr. Chairman, I'm just trying to get a comparison of the treatment of the two plans relative to the big plan we have for the state. So I'd just be curious if you could provide that to us.
I'm just
wanting to see how they're treated. I know Mr. Co-Chair and I were talking. I think that in the school system, they make an election when they retire, whoever is receiving the benefit, that if they receive less and should something happen to them, the spouse would receive that amount. And I was just curious if that's the way we treat people in the judicial system as well. I see Norm nodding his head. That's the way we do it.
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
So they're similar.
Mr. Co-Chair, there are statutes that require when a judge decides to retire under this plan, who was appointed prior to 98, they have to identify what benefit they want and spouse, if necessary, what percentage.
And then the new one is different then, right, Mr. Chairman? The new one's a little different?
The new one, Mr. Co-Chair, I think the spouse is only allowed up to 50% of that benefit of that retiring judge.
I'm more concerned about the consistency. Yeah. I think it sounds like they're the same then.
They're very similar.
Thank you.
Okay. Very good.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, and then looking at the base budget compared to the standard budget, there's a fairly steep jump there. Is that because of more people in the system, or what's the explanation behind that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, as you can see, we did have 16 retirees included in the base budget. We had 4 additional retirees in this current moving forward in the next biennium. And also, when a salary is increased for an acting justice or district judge, those benefits under this retirement system are also reflected.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add just a clarification, Representative Stubson, this is the old plan. And they went up as the judges' salaries went up. The folks under the new plan have had no increases, and that's sort of another topic for another day. That fund is in very good shape, and we would like to request the retirement board to consider cost of living increases for those retirees. But that's a different discussion.
Yeah. Been through that one. Okay.
Okay. Any more questions on judicial retirement? Okay, next, Mr. Chairman, we have the Board of Judicial Policy and Administration on page 91 and 92. I'll go over this particular budget. This budget covers all three divisions again, not only the Supreme Court, but District Court and Circuit Courts. A majority of our funds are used to provide what we call Westlaw, which is an online search engine on case law. We are requesting an exception budget request of $48,000 to help offset the increase of $38,800 to the Westlaw contract, and also $9,200 to cover the increased cost of bar dues for employees of the judicial branch. And I don't know if you recall or not, but in 2007, the Attorney General's office had an AG opinion that if it was a requirement of an attorney to work for the state or the state of Wyoming to be a member of the bar, then the state of Wyoming should provide those bar dues. And that is in line with our request. If I turn your...
Mr. Chairman, Don, would you find out if like when we are professional engineers, if the state picks up their tab, their bill to be a member of the professional engineers group or any of those other professional societies? I just want to see if we're consistent. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I do want to point out on page 93, that is a spreadsheet that provides you the overall view of this particular budget. You do see in the 100 series is there is $150,000. That covers the unfunded liability of buyouts of annual leave and sick leave for the entire judicial branch. Again, you moving down, I want to point out in the 900 series, last year you provided $100,000 to help offset the cost of security for law enforcement to provide in high-profile cases. We currently have one request from here in Laramie County for approximately $50,000. So whatever is not used by the end of this biennium will revert to the general fund. But I do want to say that those funds have been very beneficial, and the local law enforcement were happy to be able to maybe tap into those funds when they had not provided in their particular budgets for overtime or those kinds of expenses. So I just want to bring that to your attention. So, Mr. Chairman, again, total exception budget request of $48,000 in this particular division for a total budget of $708,341.
Okay.
And that concludes our Supreme Court budget presentation. If there are any follow-up questions.
Any other questions, members? Okay, we appreciate it. Well done, and appreciate all the information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Certainly, yes. Welcome, Judge. Okay, please go ahead. The floor is yours. Introduce yourself for the record. And
all right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Nick Deegan. I serve as a district judge up in the 6th Judicial District. There are, as I'm sure you know, 23 district judges spread across 9 judicial districts. And I'm here as chairman of the District Judges Conference this year, advancing their respective budgets. I want to thank you for the opportunity to do this. Before I get started, I wanted to thank Joanne Odendahl, the court administrator, because she's of invaluable help to the district court judges in crunching the numbers and getting things organized in our respective budgets. Now, in terms of what a district court does, you'll note that each of these 23 proposed budgets has a narrative at the head of it explaining how that judge perceives his or her court operates and what the responsibilities are. And I won't go into that in any detail, but just for your reference, if you want to thumbnail it, on page 26, I thought the description provided of the responsibilities of the district court by the court down in Green River was really a good one. So if you want a greater explication of what district courts do, I think that's a really fine one. Okay. All right, in terms of these budgets, there are only 8 courts that have exception requests. 4 of those requests are generically identical, different in amount, and then there are 3 others. So there's not a lot of exception requests coming out of the district courts. This go around.
Okay.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, do you want me to march through each of
That'd
these?
That'd be great. We'll just flip page by page. And you can
All right. Let's
go pretty
turn.
Fast, and we'll just interrupt if we have questions.
All right. Let's turn to
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well,
thank you. Before we get there,
I just
had a general question because I just kind of found out about it the other day. But it's my understanding that through the judicial selection process, for example, the new district court judge here, that once you have the final selectees or the who are interviewed, that the district court judges then have an opportunity to meet with the selection committee and give their recommendations for the final selectees. And I'm curious to know where that came from, how that policy was initiated, and what any feedback from you and/or Justice Kite with regards to that issue.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I'm unaware of any such procedure. Perhaps the Chief Justice wishes to speak to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, that is a practice that the Commission chose to follow to gain more information and. Under their rules and under the Constitution, they're entitled to do their own research, and they, you know, they can do it collectively or they can do it individually. They call people, I mean, they have letters of recommendation, of course, and then they call around and talk to lawyers or talk to judges or talk to whoever they want to, and they have found it to be efficient to have somebody just sit down with the judges and get their reaction and their recommendations. Sometimes it's just the judge has already written a letter, and sometimes they find out more information that is helpful to their decision-making process.
And Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that by that process, the two sitting district court judges basically have a they can rule out certain lawyers from being on the bench just by their appearance informally with the committee.
Well, obviously that would be theoretically possible, but I can tell you that the selection process, that's one piece of information that goes in with many others, and there is no way that that group follows the recommendation of anybody in a formulaic way. It's just an additional piece of information.
And so, Mr. Chairman, so that's a policy that the Commission established. How long has that policy been in effect?
I don't know if policy is even the right description. It is a practice this Commission has followed for maybe the past year, year and a half, something like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Chairman, just to make clear, the district judges conference Representative Nicholas has no formal involvement in that process.
I appreciate that clarification.
All right. Mr. Chairman, moving to page DC-4, this is the budget request submitted by Judicial District 1A. This is Judge Campbell out of Laramie County. And there is an exception request here, which you'll see several of these. This is one of four along these lines for $12,000 under 901 for professional fees. And the genesis of that is that in those districts where court commissioners are fairly regularly used to handle involuntary hospitalization proceedings, there are some counties that have without question footed the bill for those commissioners. My county's not one of them, but I think maybe the county commissioners wised up or something and realized they weren't responsible for paying that. I don't know how it really came about, but at this point it looks like the responsibility is sought to lie where it really does lie, which is in the judicial budget. So this request is for $12,000 out of 1A in Cheyenne.
Okay.
Any questions on 1A?
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, moving on to 1B, this is Judge Sharp out of Cheyenne as well, and he has an exception request along identical lines as I've just expressed, $12,000.
Mr. Chairman, is there any way that we can reduce the salary for one particular district court judge as compared to another?
Sure, during markup. We can.
I better bite my tongue, Mr. Chairman, and say nothing. All right.
I actually have a question about this.
Senator Perkins.
So is that a statewide practice that district court commissioners hear involuntary commitment cases?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I'm not sure it is. Just looking to our district, 6C, The preliminary hearings, really all of the hearings, typically the judges do them. For example, I do most of my own. In a pinch, because you can't really predict when somebody's going to need that kind of service, we will invoke a commissioner. But a number of years ago, Judge Price had the foresight, or I think it was Judge Perry, to have his law clerk appointed a commissioner. So she actually goes up as a commissioner at no additional cost and does the 72-hour hearing. And, of course, most of these don't go to a full-blown merits hearing anyway, but I'm sure in our district we wouldn't retain commissioners to do the merits hearing. How it plays out in other districts across the state, I can't say.
Yeah.
If there are no further questions, then, Mr. Chairman, I'll continue on to 2A, and this is Rollins, Judge Waldrop, Carbon County. There is no exception request. Moving on to 2B, Judge Donnell in Laramie. There's no exception request. Moving on to 3B, Judge Lavery.
And you can just reference a page number just for the record, each one. That'd be great.
All right. In addition to the court, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, same thing.
All right, I'm sorry.
No, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, Judicial District 3B, page 23, Judge Lavery, over in Green River. No exception budget request. 3A, page 29, Judge Sanderson, over in Evanston, no exception budget request. 4A, page 34, Judge Fenn, up in Sheridan, no exception budget request. 5A, page 39, Judge Scar, over in Worland, and now, he's got a like exception request as the previous ones I've described, but in less amount, $8,000, but the reasoning is the same.
Okay. Ms. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. On 5A, which is just Scar, and 5A, just notice down here when we look at the full-time, most of these have the full-time employee count is 4 for most of these, and I just noted on 5A that they're 6, and I know that you're the president of the Judicial Conference and probably have not that much familiarity with 5A, but I'm just wondering if we know the reason why there's 6 employees in that judicial district when most others have 4.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, if I might have a moment. Mr. Chairman, I've consulted with the court administrator, and the reasoning for that, Senator Perkins, is the water litigation, which appears actually as a separate a budget item here as we move along.
Next.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on the water litigation, are you talking about the Walton rights and those issues that Judge Hartman was taking care of up there? I thought that was pretty well behind us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, I'm told it's not. They're hoping it soon will be. But the next budget request that we'll be getting to addresses just that, and there's a request for $100,000, an exception request there. And maybe the court administrator can flesh that out a little bit.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Meyer.
Yeah.
And
along those lines, can we recoup that from any party, or is that just something that the state has to pay? I mean, I'm not totally familiar with all of the opposing parties in this, but do they pay an equal amount, or I'm just wondering who pays what on the special master?
Mr. Chairman, if I might invite the court administrator to perhaps respond to that for Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, more direct to your question, I don't know of any way to recoup any of the costs for this ongoing 40-year case. I really don't. The request that they have on page 45 under this water litigation unit it's for $100,000 that drops out every year and then has to be re-requested to cover the cost of that special master. I'm told by the state engineer's office as well as Judge Scar that, again, they are trying to tie up loose ends. They are hoping to have it finished within this next biennium. But, again, different problems or questions continue to arise. So this has been an ongoing request.
So, Mr. Chairman, follow-up, I guess, is that we pay 100% of the special master and no one else pays anything, yet we're basically the defendant in this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, yes. I mean, the state of Wyoming has covered the cost. At one time, the funds to pay for this water litigation was taken out of the Water Development Commission funds. Several years ago, I believe it was Representative Hageman that asked that these funds be come out of the general fund.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to continue?
Proceed. Yeah.
Page 47, we see 5B. This is Judge Cranfill up in Park County, and there is no exception budget request there. 6A, my colleague Judge Rumpke up in Campbell County, and there is no exception budget request there. 7A, Judge Forgy in Casper, no exception budget request.
That's on page 57.
I'm sorry.
Is that right? No.
Did we miss Judge Cranfill?
No,
we did that one? Okay.
Would you like to go back to that?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, am I going too quickly? Do you want
No.
All right. All right. In any event, 7A, Judge Forgy, page 57 out of Casper, no exception budget request there. 7B, page 61, Judge Sullins out of Casper, no exception budget request. Now, 9A is Judge Young, who joins us here today. And, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, if I could invite him up to present his exception budget
request.
That'd be
great. Welcome, Judge. Just push the mic. Yep. There you go. You're live now.
All right.
Go ahead.
This exception request is for $110,000, and it is to provide for a halftime employee for the district court in my district, and I want to emphasize the fact that this is not for a new employee. This employee exists and is at work, hopefully, as we speak right now. Some 30 years ago, one of my predecessors, Judge Cale, was able to convince the Fremont County Commissioners to fund this halftime position. And so it has been part of the district court in Lander for, as I say, approximately 30 years. Last year, or this spring, actually, when the county commissioners were involved in their budgeting process, they began to ask the question, are we statutorily required to fund not only this position but throughout their responsibility? And the answer to that, they determined, and quite honestly, is no, they are not required to do that. And so they have told me that in the absence of funding by the state, they intend to eliminate that position effective this June. It has become an integral part of the court's business in Fremont County. The most recent the weighted caseload study shows that the courthouse need in Fremont County is for approximately 1.8 judges. Judge Tyler comes from Sublette County and takes about half of that caseload for me. We have a regular, he gets one of every five, I think, civil cases and one of every six criminal cases or vice versa. But that method, he takes approximately half the load. I take the balance. And this position has, as I say, just become integral. It's basically an administrative thing. This person pays all the bills, manages the budgets, does all of those sorts of things. She also does a considerable amount of paralegal work as well. She reviews files and does all of those sorts of things. So I've come to depend on it, and it's become a very important part of my ability to function as the judge in Fremont County. There are some other factors that I think make our county a little bit unique. I've already mentioned that Judge Tyler comes on a regular basis. He does not, he's not assigned there. He doesn't have to come there, but he does. In a certain sense, it's a single judge setting there, but it's a multi-judge district. And my judicial assistant has to coordinate all of those different schedules and courtroom needs and all of that sort of stuff. There are some other factors that make our court particularly busy. We are blessed with a pretty nice auxiliary courtroom, and we have a nice and a spacious law library, and as a result, and we're centrally located. There are a lot of bankruptcy hearings, driver's license hearings, Employment Security Commission hearings, all of those sorts of administrative things that also take place in our courtroom or in our facilities, and my JA ends up spending a lot of time coordinating all of that. There's just some systemic things that that make the district courts a little busier than they used to be, and some of them have come up today. There was some mention of the pro se packets, and those are a great thing, and they've been a good thing for a lot of people, but what happens in the real world, at least in the courthouse in Fremont County, is they go to the clerk, they buy the packet, they come up the hall to the law library, they sit down and they start through the packet, and then they get up and walk across the hall to my JA and say, can you help me with this? Which even to politely say no takes a considerable amount of her time. So that's kind of where I am, and that's the reasons for the request, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions?
Yeah, Senator Rebaugh. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. More for Nick. Are there other counties that this situation exists and they'll wake up and realize they should be paid, or is this an isolated example, or do we know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, I'm unaware of any other counties where this is happening, and it's the kind of thing that would probably percolate to the top in discussion amongst the district court judges if it was there, but maybe Judge Young knows more than I know.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, my understanding is, and it may also contribute to the current position of the commissioners in Fremont County, that Judge Cranfield in Park County had a full-time, had the same setup, only full-time instead of part-time. The commissioners there made the same decision. They eliminated the position in the next year. I'm next up, so I don't really think that's a coincidence. But to my knowledge, those are the only two that existed in the past.
Mr. Chairman, Norm, who has that position now?
Currently, today, the person that's supposed to be at work right now, that would be Annette Brager is her name now.
Is that Judy's old position? Or
that's
what?
Judy's old position, okay. Representative Nicholas. It is.
Okay. Senator Perkins.
And anyway, it's nice for you to come up today, Judge Young. It's good to see
you.
Just a quick question for you. I just was wondering, I mean, going just trying to remember back to the days when I was a county commissioner, that it seemed to me that, unless I remember incorrectly, that the clerk of the district court was the one that handed out the pro se stuff and dealt with the polite declination to provide additional legal services, also did scheduling in the courtrooms, and also did and kept track of the budget expenditures for the judges. And I mean that's what I remember as a county commissioner. I could be wrong, and I'm just wondering between Judge Deegan, if it works that way, or who does some of those projects in your county, Judge Deegan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, and you're talking about the pro se packets.
Yeah, the pro se packets.
Mike.
Really, all of that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, to my knowledge, at least in our district, happens within the four walls of our district. It doesn't happen across the hall with the clerk of court.
Okay. Anything else?
If I might address Senator Perkins, I think you're correct in what you're saying. In fact, the pro se thing just, I think, depends on the layout of the courthouse more than anything. If you had the clerk of the district court from Fremont County in front of you, she would say, truthfully, we take all kinds of questions about the pro se packets. It tends to break down on who they, the first door they arrive at. You know, if they, like I say, a lot of people just come up to the hall, to the law library, and they sit down and they start working on it. And when they hit a wall, they start looking for help, and a fair number of them end up in my office, and a fair of them, number of them go back down the hall. I think you're right about the layout of who does those things. In fact, we've had some discussions about, I've had discussions with the clerk and the county clerk about what happens if this position disappears. And I've said, well, it's not going to be us that absorbs the entirety of it. There's some of those things that the both of you will do. The county clerk will handle some budget things. The clerk of the district court will handle some of the scheduling things. I mean, we will make it work, but we've adjusted the routine in our county for years to this particular situation.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nichols.
Norm, does the Teton Court come down and exchange sittings with you like they did before, back in the rank days, or is it?
No,
it's all Judge Tyler now?
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative, what has changed that is it's still kind of the same thing, but not, because what's changed it is there's Judge Tyler in Pinedale. What's changed is he now comes and does what Judge Rank used to do, to use your example. Could I remark about one more thing? I probably overstayed my welcome.
No,
but,
you've traveled long ways to be here. So
I made some notes about some of the things that came up today, like the video equipment, for instance. That has been a magnificent thing, at least for me in our courthouse. I've said, for instance, that Judge Tyler does about half of a caseload for the court there, and he does a great deal of that by video. And you think about that. I mean, he in days gone by, he would have driven 135 miles one way over South Pass to do three arraignments.
Yeah.
Now he does that from his office in 30 minutes because of that video equipment. But another point to that, and I was thinking about it with respect to Representative Esquivel's inquiry, I found at one point we were scheduling civil jury trials. If you wanted a first stack, which means that's the case for that day and there's nothing in front of you, it was well out over a year in Fremont County. I started asking about that. What's going on? What's causing that? And in many cases, I found out it was the schedules of expert witnesses, doctors, engineers, whomever that are needed as experts in the case, who are in New York or Houston or Denver or wherever. It's their schedules that were driving the docket of a district judge in Lander, Wyoming. And that recording equipment, that video equipment, changes all of that. Because you don't have to wait for their schedule to accommodate travel to Fremont County and all of that. You can just say, well, he can testify all right, but he's going to testify by video, and he's going to do it in the next 8 months, not a year and 8 months. And so there's some unseen and tremendous benefits of that video equipment, for instance, that aren't quantifiable in terms of how often it gets used and the cost of it. At least in my court, it's dramatically decreased the time that you can expect to get your civil jury trial held.
Well, just imagine it had all been different if Lander would have been the state capital, like originally planned.
Is that a motion?
Well, that'll be later in markup. We're going to have that opportunity when we renovate, you know. We're going to move out for a couple of years, so... Okay, very good. Any other questions? Appreciate you traveling all the way down
here.
It's
been a pleasure. It's been very
informative. Appreciate it. Appreciate your presentation and your service.
Thank you.
Okay, Chief Justice?
Mr. Chairman, if I could say one thing about district court budgets.
Mike, grab that mic there real quick. Then we'll have you on the record there.
There we go. I think this is a question of kind of timing. In that these budgets were prepared when they were October, November. You should have received or are going to receive a letter from Joint Judiciary making a recommendation with regard to the pay for district court reporters who are certified on real time. We have been doing a lot of work to try to make the court reporting side of the judicial process more efficient and effective. For you that haven't experienced it, court reporters have to take down the shorthand on a machine, then go back and translate it and make a transcript, and it's obviously a slower process than what they can do when they're trained in real time, which is my best understanding is a much more computerized, faster, more accurate shorthand. But it's difficult to do. I think there are only two real-time certified reporters in the state. Judge Deegan, you might correct me. Judge Donnell has one, and Judge Couts has one. Joint Judiciary, Judge Young has one. Joint Judiciary wants to encourage all of our court reporters to be real-time, and many other states you can't be a court reporter unless you're real-time certified, Utah, Colorado. And we have three out of 23. So they would like to have the real-time reporters have a 10% bump in their salary to encourage the rest of them to get real-time. This really would have a dramatic effect on their efficiency, district court judges' efficiency, preparation of transcripts, the speed in preparation of transcripts, the accuracy, the whole bringing the court reporting profession into the 21st century as well. So those agencies did not have that in their exception requests because the joint judiciary process was working kind of parallel to the budget process. So I don't know what the right process is, but Judge Deegan can expand upon that. But that would be the request of the Joint Judiciary Committee to the Appropriations Committee. And I know the Board of Judicial Policy and our court would wholeheartedly endorse that because we should have it across the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Kocher.
Yeah, before the Chief Justice gives up the mic, and you know, I remember now the magistrate issue in that bill. The area we thought we could save some money was in the court reporting because of some of the places where we really didn't need to have them in there. As I recall, was there not some discussion about that? Then it got controversial and got bogged down. But you thought there could be a substantial savings if we could work out the political side of it. Is that still a doable thing or not?
Yes, although I think it's slightly different. We were trying to get circuit judges able to stand in for district judges and help relieve the workload, but they can't because the court reporter for the district judge is occupied. So we made the cardinal sin of suggesting maybe we should try digital recording instead of court reporter, and that started the war. There are still lots of district judges using digital recording for backup and purposes to improve their operations, but not to replace the court reporter. So we're still kind of in that box unless there is more use of digital recording, but that's a different issue than the real time.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I understand it's different, and there was a pretty substantial savings if you could do more of the digital, as I recall, was there not? But there was the issues about you couldn't understand. I mean,
all that.
You could make all kinds of reasons why not to do something if you just don't want to do it. But what was the amount of money you looked at?
I don't know. The transcript costs were. The total transcripts costs were a couple million dollars, but that wouldn't save at all. The amount of district court's budgets for transcripts is significant. The bigger problem, and I really don't want to get you off track almost lunch, but is that we have a statute that mandates the creation of transcripts, which many states do not have and which create transcripts that aren't read. Now, nobody disputes that you should have a transcript for everything anybody wants a transcript for, but generating unnecessary transcripts is something that the Board of Judicial Policy recommended we change that statute. That got lost in the same debate over court reporters. So there's a lot of court reporter issues still out there, but this one was a positive, constructive, nobody disagreed with kind of approach of let's pay these real-time reporters more so we can encourage these other people to get certified.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and you know, we're making a lot of progress on the digital side and the electronic side, and I don't know, maybe that one of the judges, Judge Young or Judge Nagin, could comment, but it seems to me if we have a lot of reproduction of documents that we never look at, why would we, I mean, if it's a statutory change, if we're the political animal, we could I mean, maybe it's just something that you've already been scarred and it's not worth talking about. But it seems to me if we could save money, that would be a good area.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Vibot, the problem is if you, in some of the smaller districts, if you don't make those mandatory transcripts, you actually reduce the pay that some of those court reporters would make. And that's the problem. But if they get real-time certified and we'd give them a 10% raise, it would probably be a so it's again why we'd like to encourage you at least to, when you get that communication from judiciary, to act on it favorably. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else? Members? Anything, Judge?
Mr. Chairman, I'll continue to march through the remaining judicial districts, but I would take the opportunity.
One left, I think. Is there one or two left? Go ahead.
Several left, but on this topic, if I might, Mr. Chairman, on incentive pay for real-time reporters, Ms. Odendahl has put together some numbers to give you an idea of what that would amount to, and if I could momentarily turn the floor over to her.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as Chief Justice Kite indicated, by time these budget books were put together, Joint Judiciary had not met yet. The cost to provide a 10% pay increase for the two that we knew about and benefits would be a biennial cost of $27,563 in the next biennium. If all court reporters became real-time certified, it would be a biennial cost of $289,000, which is substantially cheaper than covering the cost of transcripts, you know, the $3.25 per page. If you have real-time reporting, the time or the necessary requirement to transcribe some of that documentation goes away. So, again, there would be the trade-off in some instances, not all. But that is just to give you a little bit of information. I have not seen a letter from Joint Judiciary yet, but Senator Schiffer indicated they took a vote that they would be providing you that encouragement to provide that funding into the district court budgets.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, continue, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to 8A, page 70, Judge Couts, down in Torrington. There's no exception budget request there. 9B, page 76, Judge Day, out of Teton County. No exception budget request there. 6B, page 81, Judge Perry, my colleague up in Gillette. No exception budget request there. 8B, page 86, Judge Brooks, out of Douglas. No exception budget request. 1C, page 90, Judge Arnold from here in Cheyenne. And he's got an exception budget request alike to what his two colleagues have put in for the $12,000 in 901 for the court commissioners who handle involuntary hospitalization proceedings. 3C on page 95, Judge James out of Green River, no exception budget request. 7C, page 100, Judge Wilking out of Casper. No exception budget request. 6C out of Gillette, yours truly, page 104. You'll find a $2,500 budget request exception in there. And if I might explain, I'm really speaking for all three judges. We just thought it would be easier to funnel it through one budget. What this is for is this. The legislature authorized the creation of a new judgeship in the 4th, Scituate in Buffalo. And Judge Edelman has been conducting business there. And we got with Judge Edelman, my two colleagues and myself, Mr. Chairman, and he agreed to help us out on somewhat of a regular basis over in Campbell County. And that would require a payment of mileage for him and his court reporter. And we're kind of tiptoeing into this. We've tried to set Judge Edelman up for a couple of times a month, just have a day, a Friday. And we've run into some real scheduling problems making that work as well as we would like it to work. And another thought we have now is maybe just assigning actual cases from stem to stern to him to where he could set the times. But in any event, we do want to use him and be able to call on him, and he's more than willing to help. And I think that was maybe one of the reasons in creating that judgeship. It was to provide some surplus judge resource to help other counties, and we're right next door, and he's willing to do it, and we'd love to have him. So that's what that $2,500 is for, and it's intended to be spread over three judges.
Okay.
District 9C, page 109, Judge Tyler out of Pinedale, and there is no exception budget request there. 4B, Judge Edelman out of Buffalo, page 113.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Judge Deegan, how do they handle the travel for Judge Tyler when he goes to Lander?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, I think the rule of thumb actually in the statute is that if a judge comes into your district to help you, it comes out of your budget. That being said, I think the practice over the years has been a little bit more relaxed, and if people are traveling to another district to help out, they just take it out of their budget. With respect to Judge Tyler, I don't know the answer.
Mr. Chairman, Judge Deegan, if I might add, a few years ago, after Judge Tyler had started helping Judge Young, it was apparent that a lot of miles were being put on his personal car. The Board of Judicial Policy has a policy that identifies if any judge travels more than 10,000 miles per year, they can request an appropriation to purchase a state car. Judge Tyler was able to secure funds from you all in the last biennium to provide that state car. So the mileage is essentially covered in the use of the state car and the monthly fee that goes then to the maintenance. So.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Chairman, again, 4B, Judge Edelman in Buffalo, page 113, no exception budget request there. And that,
Mr. Chairman, would Judge Edelman rather have a car?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, that's another one. I just think I'm safer to say no comment at this point. Mr. Chairman, before I yield here, if I might just add, and I think I'm speaking for all of the district judges here, and that is to say that on this use of the J-band system, the video system, I think we're all thrilled with it.
Yeah.
It really helps us out. For example, in the 6, we traveled to Crook and Weston, and on occasion we need to use it out of those counties, especially when there's an impromptu seizure of a neglected child, a child's placed in custody. You have to have a hearing within 48 hours, that kind of thing. So it's been great.
Okay. Well, appreciate your service traveling down here, and safe travels home.
Thank you. Thank you for all of your consideration.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? And we're going to break for lunch.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I was in and out, and I had a couple of things to take care of. Did we do Board of Law Examiners?
We're going to I think we'll do that when we come back.
Okay.
We've got that on our schedule after. That's 102, and on the schedule it's 103 and then 102 at about 1:30.
Okay.
Okay,
I got it.
Okay, so we'll be back at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much.